Folks, we'll call this meeting of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee to order. Thank you for coming. In Minnesota, as well as across the country, we've seen something of akin to a flu epidemic with the number of employee lockouts that have been occurring. It used to be a relatively infrequent occurrence. Now it seems to be becoming more and more frequent. So we're going to learn a little bit about those. We've got literally in Minnesota right now four that I'm aware of, perhaps more, in which entities, businesses that have promised economic activity and jobs in exchange for public tax dollars have done that. Then the next, not long after, in some cases, have engaged in lockout activities that have jeopardized jobs and economic activity. My purpose in holding this hearing today is to get a little bit more complete picture. I know of at least two potential pieces of legislation, but before those are introduced or make any move forward, the aim being to prevent or discourage lockout behavior. Before that happens, I thought it might benefit us to have a more complete picture of what's going on. We don't have, as the various folks around the table know, the Commerce Committee doesn't have rules. We just try to treat each other in a nice fashion and employ the golden rule. But I would ask if you've got signs that are in people's way that you place those signs down. If you've got coats on chairs, we've obviously got some folks that are unable to find seats at this point. If you've got a coat that's sitting in a chair that's preventing somebody from sitting down, if you can place that under your seat or in your lap and just try to be respectful of others in the room. With that, I believe that Mayor Coleman is going to join us shortly. He's got a meeting that he's on his way from, but we've got some folks here to testify relative to that. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before the mayor or whoever's going to start comes down, we didn't get finished with the health care exchange bill yesterday. Do you have a ballpark time frame of how long we're going to spend on this before we get to the exchange, or do you want to do the exchange first and then get to this? I think it would be illuminating discussion for everyone.
And we are, and I appreciate your raising that point. We do intend to do the balance of the exchange bill. We heard plenty of testimony yesterday regarding that. This afternoon yet, we're going to take up that bill as well. My guesstimate is that we'll spend half an hour to an hour hearing about lockouts, and then after that we'll continue with our discussion of the exchange bill, which was added to the agenda today. And I appreciate, by the way, Representative Davids, Representative Hoppe sharing a concern, as well as Representative Anderson and others on both sides, about the opportunity to have the bill heard on a second day. So we were happy to add it to today's agenda as well, and we'll look forward to further discussion of it. With that, we'll turn to
Mr. Chair, do we need to be out of here at 5:30 today? Is there anybody scheduled for the basement after this?
Nope.
We got piles of questions.
We've got it until Sunday or Monday, as I understand it, Representative Hoppe.
And you should be able to get her in time then.
As you saw, by the way, you probably noticed as you were walking in the tradition, it's a new tradition here that we are going to be greeted with orchestral music as we walk into the Commerce Committee. Whoever was playing, I believe it was the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra musicians, thank you for that. That was very kind of you to do. With that, we will turn. I believe we've got just taking in order here. Mr. Pellegrim from the Minnesota Wild. Mr. Pellegrim, welcome. I think welcome back to the committee as you're coming down. We do have a quorum. We've got the minutes from yesterday's meeting, which I'm sure everyone has thoroughly reviewed. Representative Sundin moves those minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Thank you. Mr. Pellegrim, welcome back to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. My name is Jeff Pellegrim. I am the Chief Financial Officer of the Minnesota Wild. I am appearing today at the request of Chairman Atkins to give brief testimony and take questions on the recent work stoppage in the NHL. First of all, I would like to express my relief, and that would be the most appropriate adjective for how I feel about this and how all folks at the Wild, both the players and of management, feel about this would be relief, that after 4 months of negotiations on January 12th, the National Hockey League and the NHL Players Association approved a 10-year collective bargaining agreement that ended the work stoppage. As you all probably know, this past Saturday on Hockey Day Minnesota, the Minnesota Wild returned to the ice, beginning a 48-game abbreviated regular season. The Wild played their season opener to a capacity crowd and rewarded their loyal fans with a thrilling 4-2 victory over Colorado. The excitement continued on Sunday night with another sellout and a 1-0 victory over the Dallas Stars. You know, kind of a side note of that deal, if you weren't watching over that game, one of our goaltenders, Josh Harding, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis over the summer, and he ended up starting that game and having a shutout. So that was a great way to come back, and congratulations to Josh with that. I'm sure there's a lot more of that story to be told. TV ratings for both those games on FSN were at playoff levels. We couldn't have even thought that things would come back like they did. Now, all I can say for myself and the entire Wild organization is that we are humbled and thankful for the remarkable response of our fans, of the community, for all those in the state of hockey that support us. I'd like to take this opportunity to honestly apologize to those that were negatively affected by the lockout. Some of those folks are in this room. And all I can say is we're sorry for all the negative impacts that occurred during this. We know the lockout was particularly difficult for our fans, for St. Paul businesses around the Xcel Energy Center, for their employees who count on us to play hockey, and for our own part-time and full-time employees who all took reduced hours and reduced pay during the work stoppage. It affected all of these people, their families, their businesses. And all I can say is that I'm genuinely sorry for all the issues the lockout caused. We want this community to know that we are not blind to the impacts of work stoppages or this work stoppage that just happened around us. Quite to the contrary, we are members in this community. We frequent
businesses. Mr. Chairman, if we could we have the signs put down, please? It's a bit untawdry. The signs that
what
are up
signs?
Here.
I don't see any signs. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, and folks, I asked earlier, I'm sure you just didn't hear that we've got, if you could keep signs down, they tend to get in people's way. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. I'm sorry, Mr. Pellegrin.
That's okay. And we are part of the community. We frequent the businesses around the Xcel Energy Center. In fact, we made a special effort to frequent them more often during the work stoppage. We talked to the owners. We talked to our fans a lot. They came and spoke to us, and we've spoken to them since. And so we understand a lot of the impacts, and as part of the community, we are working hard to make amends. Some of the things that we're doing as examples. Last week, to welcome back our fans and local businesses, we created a new event for us. It was called Wild Wednesday. We opened up our building to 13,000 fans for a free inter-squad scrimmage. Our fans witnessed for the first time Zach Parise and Ryan Suter wearing Wild jerseys. Also on Wild Wednesday, we thanked our fans with a 50% off merchandise sale. It looked a little bit like Black Friday there for a few hours. At one point, we had about 100 people in line, and our fans well took advantage of that offer, and we appreciate that they came back and did that. And finally, we welcomed back our individual ticket buyers with our on sale on that day, and we had overall our best day ever selling individual tickets for that day. So we were just overwhelmed by that response. To welcome back our local businesses, we've been giving local bars and restaurants around the Xcel free tickets for the next few home games to give to their patrons to try to help them bring those fans back into their, and to thank the fans that did come in or the patrons that did come in during the work stoppage. And we hope just to be back with 18,000 folks around the Xcel for the 21 remaining home games we have, playoffs and beyond. Finally, the NHL Players Association and the NHL gave us all a gift. It's a 10-year labor agreement so that we won't have to think about this for now for another 10 years. We don't have to worry about labor negotiations and conference rooms. We instead can focus on hockey games, making the playoffs, hopefully a Winter Classic in the near future in the Twin Cities. And finally, I want to thank our fans, partners, employees, city officials for their unbelievable support as we pursue our ultimate goal, bringing the Stanley Cup to the state of hockey. Mr. Chairman and members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have at this time.
And thank you, Mr. Pellegrim. I think like we did with our hearing last night, we're going to hold off on questions for now and just, in fact, the next person that's got to testify has to work at 5.
Okay.
So we'll go next to Ms. Highland, Meg Highland, who's a server at the Eagle Street Restaurant. One of my personal frustrations in the discussion, at least the NHL strike, was that we heard a lot about the impact on the players and on the team, but didn't hear as much from the folks who were being hurt through no fault of their own. And that was the servers and the bartenders and the parking lot attendants and security people. So, Ms. Highland, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate it. My name is Meg Highland, and I am the event coordinator for Eagle Street Grill, which is located just across the street from the Xcel Energy Center. Thankfully, the NHL has ended the lockout. We just had 3 great nights at Eagle Street for the beginning of the NHL season. It's unfortunate that the first 3 games of the NHL season didn't happen until January, but we're hoping that we can make up for some of that lost business with a playoff run, and we can have some of our customers come back for patio season. The NHL has impacted a lot of people, businesses, families. I'm a single mom, so I had to go on a very tight budget to help manage my way through this last 6 months. I have 2 kids that play hockey, which obviously is a luxury, but being a St. Paul mom, I didn't want to take that away from my children. The irony is that my family budget was impacted by the NHL for these kind of things for my kids. I wanted to make sure that my kids don't see this blip for anything for the things they want to do. I think from a business perspective, my business owner, people that I work for, they had to make some really, really difficult decisions. We had to cut back on all of our staff to get through the lockout. We cut about 3/4 of our population at work. We're lucky now that most of our employees came back and where we were able to do that, and we're all really excited for the remainder of the season. For me, as an event coordinator at Eagle Street, it was easier for me to pursue some other options for our business. We had a lot of parties, special events. We tried to fill up our restaurant with these things for our staff, but it does not even come close to what we bring in revenue-wise when there's a hockey game. I want to thank everybody for taking the time for the last few months and listening to our stories. I know there's a lot of people who have had something to say about this. I hope that all the parties involved can look at this and hope that we don't have to go through this again, and that those of us that were affected don't have to deal with this again. It was really difficult for small businesses in particular, and for the employees and for myself. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Highland. And we're glad to see you're going to work at 5. And hopefully there will be a lot of people there to, in spite of no hockey game this evening. But we've been joined by Mayor Coleman. If you want to wander on down, we'd love to hear from you. One of the figures that we got from our own nonpartisan staff was the impact on if the entire season had been lost. The impact in state sales, income, and alcohol tax revenues would be about $5.9 million. I know in the city of St. Paul, they talked about the loss of economic activity somewhere in the neighborhood of $9 million. Mayor Coleman, I'll turn it over to you. Welcome back to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Coleman, Mayor of the city of St. Paul, and I promise you this is not my calculator. No idea what to do with that. I appreciate the fact that the committee has taken an opportunity to dive into a little bit of the issues surrounding the NHL lockout. Let me say first and foremost, in spite of the failed clearing attempt last night that cost us the game, we are very, very excited to have hockey back. Hockey is part of the fabric not just of the city of St. Paul, but of the state of Minnesota, and obviously we're very excited to have those games back. No one is more excited to have the NHL back than the bars and restaurants and the people that are dependent upon the activity that occurs in and around the Xcel Energy Center. Those 40-plus nights of hockey a year, hopefully more when we get into the playoffs in a full season, will be absolutely critical for the success of those businesses. And it's not necessarily even the ones that you think of. You know, Eagle Street Grill, which is directly across from the Xcel, a bar, restaurant. A lot of people stop in for a drink beforehand. But it's Sakura Sushi because a lot of the players use or eat sushi as part of their pregame meal. And so she was dependent upon catering business for that, as well as other people stopping in to grab a bite to eat before or after a game. We told the story many times during the course of the lockout, actually leading up to the lockout, about waitresses and bartenders and other staff in those facilities or those restaurants, establishments that were very, very dependent upon the income that they received during the course of NHL games in order to be able to, quite frankly, put their kids through hockey programs. I think one of the touching stories we heard was one of the waitresses who was unable to afford a hockey program because of the lost income. I want to be very clear. I'm a strong supporter of collective bargaining rights. I believe that that's an important thing. I think sometimes that message gets a little bit lost when we're talking about professional athletes. It doesn't seem quite the same thing. But I don't think that this is the conversation that we should. I think we need to be careful how we have this conversation. But what I do want to say is I think it's important when cities invest in assets like the XL Energy Center. Could be Target Field, it could be Target Center, it could be the new Viking Stadium, to at least have a voice at the table as some of these discussions are happening. The frustration for me was that I thought, quite frankly, more cities should have raised their voice to say, we need to be at the table as this conversation is having, because it's not just, and the Wild have been great, Craig Leopold and the owners have been very supportive, and they understood the challenges and the problems that were being created. But we didn't feel like we had a vehicle that we could have a conversation or that we could be a part of that. Just recently I met with at the United States Conference of Mayors this last week in Washington, D.C., the committee of folks that have professional sports franchises, including amateur, minor league clubs, et cetera. I met with them to talk a little bit about, is there a way that we as cities can be a part of that conversation? It's not like we can interject ourselves into the mediation process, but if there was simply a way that we could make sure that people understood as they were calculating whether they were going to have a lockout or a strike or any of those things, what the impact to the community would be. I don't have, nor did any of my colleagues have an answer as to how we could interject ourselves into that conversation more forcefully, but I know that in some of the previous labor disputes in professional sports, there has been a more powerful voice that has been raised. And so the frustration that we had this fall hopefully will be past us, but this is not an issue that's necessarily going to go away, and we're anxious to work with you to figure out if there's a better way for cities to really have a voice when they have so much at stake.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Stand for questions.
And I think we're going to take questions at the end. You're welcome to stay if you'd like. My guess is you've got to practice up for the crashed ice.
My practice runs at 5:30 tonight. So, and this may be the last time you see me.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mayor Coleman actually referenced the owner of Sakura Sushi. I believe it's Miyoka Ullman. Is she with us this afternoon? Yeah. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Miyoko Omori, and I own the Sakura Restaurant. And you don't have no idea how happy I am to have that, hockey come back, and it's so much different than this past 3 months. I was worried because so quiet in downtown St. Paul, and I was really, really worried. This is the first time I fear having a business, and I'm so glad that everything going good. And I don't know how to express, but I really, this time is, I'm sure the musician person is still locked out. Hopefully they'll come back and play again, because those people are more longer relationship with me, because when I come to St. Paul 22 years ago, and those are the people that support a lot to come to my place and support us. So hopefully soon this will solve the problem. And thank you for inviting me today. And I hope everything goes well. And thank you. I'm kind of nervous because this is the first time I'm coming with this many people looking at me. So I hope everything goes well. Thank you.
And thank you very much. Well, I'll be over for sushi in about an hour and a half or so, or a couple hours maybe.
Mr. Chairman, can we get the address and location?
It's right next to the X, Representative Zellers. Thank you. There was, I think, a good reference to the fact that there are other lockouts taking place. Each time this issue seems to be talked about, it's in the context of the NHL lockout. Whenever I've spoken about it, however, I've talked about there's a number of additional lockouts involving musicians, involving American Crystal, Sugar Up and Moorhead, and we've been joined next by Michael Henson, who's the president of the Minnesota Orchestral Association. And appreciate your joining us this afternoon. Look forward to hearing your testimony as well.
Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today, and I will offer a brief statement. I am Michael Henson, the president and CEO of the Minnesota Orchestra. I am very proud to be here to represent the Minnesota Orchestra, which is an exceptional organization that enjoys such an acclaimed history in this state. Our board is made up of citizen volunteers who are generous contributors to the orchestra. Speaking on behalf of the board and myself, we feel it is our responsibility and our great privilege to ensure that the 110-year legacy of this organization continues long into the future, benefiting new generations of Minnesotans for years to come. As a non-for-profit, our orchestra has three sources of income. First, ticket sales from our concerts and our events. Secondly, contributions from generous community members, corporations, foundations, and of course, the state of Minnesota. And thirdly, our endowment earnings. Over the years, generous donors have contributed to our endowment, and each year we are able to draw a percentage of those earnings to help us to sustain our operations. As an arts organization, we are not immune from the economic challenges facing the rest of the world. And during the recession, each of our revenue streams were negatively impacted, particularly our contributions and our investments. We maintained stability within the organization through those volatile years by relying upon our endowment, which was appropriate and responsible action, but it is not a sustainable one. Today, we face the reality that if we continue to draw down our endowment at the current rate, it will be depleted in 5 years' time. We cannot allow that to happen to the future of this organization. Last December, we announced a $6 million operating deficit for the orchestra. We know this deficit will continue to grow until we address our financial issues directly, and we have developed a thoughtful strategic plan to do just that. This plan calls for a combination of revenue increases, including our board members increasing their already generous gifts to the organization by 20%, as well as significant cost reductions, which we've already undertaken on the management and the administrative side of the operation. This then is the backdrop against which we are now trying to negotiate a new contract with our musicians. We understand that the impact of the lockout is felt throughout the community, and we have great empathy for those who have been impacted by this, including our musicians. No one wants the orchestra performing back on stage more than our volunteer board. Music and musicians are the very centre of our organisation, and we are seeking to negotiate a contract with our musicians that is aligned with what our community can afford. This point is worth emphasising. The Minnesota Orchestra is entirely supported by the generosity of this community, and our expenses need to be based on what this community is willing and able to give. That is the issue at the centre of our talks. I'd like to make two final points. The first is to thank you, the legislature, for the $14 million in bonding dollars you appropriated for the renovation of Orchestra Hall. That project is one of our major revenue-generating initiatives outlined in our strategic plan, and is one of the fiscal solutions to our current financial challenges. The building project is on budget and on pace for our 2013 opening, and we are currently employing approximately 130 union members of the building trades as we speak. When I first visited the site, I was asked by a construction worker what I did, and he thanked me and thanked the organisation. He said it enabled him to actually sustain a job for a year during this project, and he had been out of work for a number of months before that. We'd like to thank you for making that possible in terms of creating job stimulus.
Okay.
Secondly, I know that it has been a point of concern for some legislators that our yearly operating support from public monies might be used to fund our current negotiations or lockout. In order to eliminate all concerns around this point, we've sequestered in a separate account all state monies received to date this fiscal year. And we will continue to do the same going forward until we've reached our contract resolution. I'll reiterate that point. No state monies have been or will be used to fund these negotiations. On a personal note, I would like to close by noting that I have worked my entire professional life managing symphony orchestras in various cities around the world. My family and I were drawn to Minnesota and to this great orchestra because of its outstanding reputation. Along with our board of directors, I see it as my duty to ensure the Minnesota Orchestra remains artistically excellent and financially solvent for the future. These two goals are entirely possible to achieve in tandem, and it is only by achieving artistic and fiscal strength that we can ensure our orchestra will be around to serve this community well into the future. Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to this committee.
And thank you, Mr. Hansen. Could you speak to one point that I believe has been raised, and that is was at the time that the $14 million was awarded, the capital dollars from the state, was there an awareness or expectation of the possibility of a lockout, or did the economics of the orchestra tend to indicate that that might be a possibility at that time?
There's been no intention at any point during the application for those fundings to actually have a lockout. The board managed responsibly a very challenging situation 3.5 years ago, and we continue to hope that we weren't going to have a lockout as we actually approached the conclusion of the negotiations that we had at the start of October 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And we have up next, on behalf of the Musicians Negotiating Committee, Mr. Wright, Doug Wright. Thanks again. Mr. Doug Wright seems to travel as a team. Thank you, Representative Hortman. If the legislative thing doesn't work out for you, it could be a page, perhaps.
I was.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that was my job. You
and I are no longer qualified for that, Representative Zellers.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having us. This is most of our negotiating committee for the players. I am Tony Ross, the principal cellist of the orchestra. And I've been a member of the orchestra for 25 years.
I'm Catherine Shabilska. I'm a violinist and have been playing with the orchestra for 12 years.
Bert Hara, principal clarinet for 25 years.
Thank you, Representative Atkins and committee members, for your public service and your attention to the impact of lockouts in our region. My name is Douglas Wright, and I am proud to have been the principal trombonist of the Minnesota Orchestra for the past 18 years. During that time, I, along with my team here, have played literally thousands of concerts for millions of people here in Minnesota, throughout the nation, and around the world. From Minneapolis to Bemidji, St. Paul to St. Cloud, and Pipestone to Roseau, the Minnesota Orchestra has had the privilege to bring world-class performances of great music all over our great state. The Minnesota Orchestra has also had the honor of representing our fine state throughout the United States and abroad, and we've been proud to bring home critical acclaim and recognition for our efforts. After a 2010 performance with Osmo at Carnegie Hall, one of the most respected critics in our industry, Alex Ross of The New Yorker, went so far as to call the Minnesota Orchestra the greatest orchestra in the world. The strength of the music-loving community that supports such a world-class symphony orchestra is rooted in Minnesota's exceptional music education programs. The lockout by our management has demonstrated disregard for this greater musical community, especially students. The lockout cuts their connection to great music through the resource of the Minnesota Orchestra musicians. For years, Minnesota Orchestra musicians have served the state's thriving community and music and educational programs. We volunteer to teach, conduct and coach youth ensembles, and judge young artist competitions. In addition to our traditional concert programs, we perform in kinder concerts for preschoolers, we do school visits and instrumental clinics, and perform children's concerts in the metro and around the state. We know firsthand the well-documented value of music to students, improved reading and math scores, discipline, self-motivation, and socialization. Recent studies show that students in high school band and orchestra programs have the lowest controlled substance use of any other group studied. The musicians' latest outreach effort is to help teach and raise funds to support the new El Sistema free music education program in North Minneapolis. For years, the Minnesota Orchestra management has emphasized our work with children and school groups to the legislature. They have appealed for legacy money, touted school group visits and bonding proposals, and fundraising appeals. However, in the past 4 years, the current management has failed to schedule several weeks each season that had potential for multiple educational or outreach services. These were paid-for weeks that were simply left blank, despite musician requests and suggestions for meaningful use of these unscheduled weeks. A total of about $2 million worth of services have gone unused. Now, as part of the lockout, the current Minnesota Orchestra management has canceled youth orchestras and competitions unnecessarily. Our differences may be great, but I never imagined they would disconnect music from the community and children in this way. The musicians know that development of young musicians and students doesn't stop because of the management's lockout. So, the musicians themselves are now making plans to produce, pay for, and perform outreach and education concerts over the coming weeks to fill the void left by this lockout. The management has effectively severed a vital and unique nerve within our community in the Twin Cities and throughout Minnesota. Since this lockout began on October 1st of 2012, most of my colleagues and I have been forced to take our talents elsewhere, performing with other orchestras throughout the country and abroad. I have had the good fortune to play with some of the other world-class American orchestras, notably the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and the New York Philharmonic. In each of these places, as I describe the situation to colleagues and managers in these orchestras, I am met with looks of disbelief and astonishment at the situation here. It is quite clear that the drastic cuts and tactics being conducted here are not occurring everywhere else in this industry, despite claims to the contrary by our current administration. On the contrary, a number of our peer orchestras have recently settled contracts with modest increases and are actually filling vacancies. If this lockout continues, they're going to be filling their vacancies with our players. It is becoming increasingly clear just how isolated our current leadership has become through these tactics. In a year-end list of most notables, the aforementioned New Yorker critic Alex Ross wrote, and I quote, "A special citation for quickest plunge from a great height is handily won by the management and governing board of the Minnesota Orchestra," end quote. This lockout is not only irreparably damaging the trust between this community and our organization, it is severely tarnishing our image throughout our own industry. This will have lasting, devastating effects in attracting and retaining world-class musicians and conductors here, regardless of how this mess turns out. The good news is that through my recent travels, I have seen and heard the proof. The Minnesota Orchestra has achieved a technical ability and a level of artistry that rivals any of the great orchestras in this nation, and indeed the world. It is truly a world-class, great symphony orchestra. The bad news is, if this lockout continues much longer, it no longer will be. Furthermore, if the terms and conditions of our management's final offer, an offer that includes 30 to 50% pay cuts, a massive cost shift in health care expenses from the employer to the musicians, and an elimination of over 40 years worth of accrued working conditions, if that final offer is ever carried forward, the Minnesota Orchestra, your Minnesota Orchestra, their Minnesota Orchestra, will lose its world-class status, its major league status, as our finest players leave for higher ground, each taking their individual talents and shine along with them to other orchestras. You can see for yourselves on the chart labeled 20-year Minnesota Orchestra Salary Comparison the devastating effect their final offer will have on our orchestra compared to our peer orchestras. Management suggests, as you just heard, that their extreme proposal represents a nationwide trend. The truth is that our peer world-class orchestra in Cleveland, a city with a weaker economy and a smaller orchestra endowment, has recently, quietly, settled a contract with modest increases and is attracting record number of young people to their concerts. The Chicago Symphony has recently settled a contract with increases, and their musicians continue to serve their community through innovative outreach and education programs. The National Symphony in Washington, D.C. also managed to settle a contract with modest increases without a lockout. Surely, Minnesota's thriving music community and aspiring musicians deserve continued music from world-class mentors and performances as well. As you can see on the chart labeled 2011-2012 Major Orchestra Endowments, our generous, arts-centric community has supported this orchestra to such a degree that the Minnesota Orchestra currently has the sixth largest orchestra endowment of any American orchestra. However, management's final offer would diminish the Minnesota Orchestra's ranking from 9th to 15th among major American orchestras. On the chart labeled 2012-2013 base salaries of top 10 orchestras, you can see that management's proposal would nearly double the number of job opportunities our musicians would be able to consider, including a number of orchestras that have historically never been in the running for taking our players.
Say, Mr. Wright?
Yes.
I know why you brought four people now is because you're speaking for four.
Sorry.
I appreciate it. You're making an excellent point. But we've got some folks who are going to speak together, so I'm not too worried about staying on schedule. I just wanted to make sure that we're kind of concluding. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry.
And you were just getting warmed up.
No. the real impact of this lockout is if you take into account the proposed reduction in performances of great music, the lost opportunities for students and young musicians, the proposed cuts in the numbers of musicians and salaries, the canceled concerts, the damage and integrity of the state's largest and most venerable arts institution, this lockout unnecessarily risks leaving us all with a third-class arts resource in a world-class region and a world-class state. We didn't build Target Field for a minor league baseball team. If the Vikings win the Super Bowl, they are not handed a severe pay cut. The new Guthrie wasn't built for Minneapolis to become mediocre in the theater. As stated by Michael Henson in a 2008 Star Tribune article, there is no point in having a great building without having great art inside it. So why then would we build a $52 million lobby and take away the world-class music from within? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That was a crescendo. We have next is Carol Mason Smith, a bassoonist with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. And folks, I'm not. I don't want to cut short testimony, just like we had last night. I think Chair Fritz was talking about 3 minutes per testifier, and we went a little longer than that. It's important testimony that we're hearing. I'm just in light of the time frame that we're on. If your comments have been made by a previous testifier, if you can just share that would be terrific. Ms. Mason Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Atkins, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today. My name is Carol Mason Smith. I'm a musician with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and we are very grateful for your interest in this issue. We're hopeful you can help us get back to work, get back to doing what we love, and that is playing world-class orchestral music for our loyal audiences here in Minnesota. In addition to being a member of the Musicians Negotiating Committee, I've been playing the bassoon with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra for more than three decades. Over the years, we have had our share of contract challenges. But working collaboratively with management, we were always able to overcome our differences. Unfortunately, that is not the case today. We are sad, we are disappointed, and we are frustrated by the negotiations. In addition to giving back more than $2 million in salary concessions over the last 10 years, we have made several concessionary offers, including our latest proposal, which was delivered yesterday to our management, a framework for an agreement through 2016, which would save the management $3.6 million, $4.6 million, when we include the spending saved if the lockout were to actually end on February 8th. Unfortunately, the management has canceled concerts through March 23rd, which, while decreasing their costs even more, will increase the damage done to our musicians and their families. We have previously agreed to play more concerts and be paid less money, but that was not enough. Management wanted to cut more. Management wants fewer musicians, more artistic controls, and lower salaries. Combined, these changes could cut the heart out of this orchestra. But today, musicians will agree to go from 34 to 28 players, only if management commits to giving us a real voice in decisions about the rebuilding of our complement. Having no background or experience, this interim management does not have the ability to make those decisions alone. And without musician input, the ability to recruit and retain world-class musicians will be impossible. We propose a committee of seven members, our concertmaster, three musicians, and three management members, a committee to decide the artistic future of the Jewel of St. Paul, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. We await management's response to this latest proposal. It could allow us to get back to making music within the framework of the play and talk format, to settle major issues of pay and the number of musicians so the management can sustainably control costs. For the record, as of today, we have been locked out 93 days. During that time, we have spent many hours in the state of Minnesota's unemployment offices. We have spent a great deal of time looking for new jobs and even for new careers. Several of us are no longer even working as professional musicians, and some of us have sold our homes and moved out of this community, which we love. I speak for all the musicians of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra when I repeat, we want to be part of the solution of this organization. We want to return to the stage, and we want to make music for our community. We want our management to end this lockout, even while we continue to talk through any remaining contract differences. Thank you. Chairman Atkins, thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you for your time as well and for your testimony. Next up is Claire Gibbons. And like a couple of our earlier testifiers relative to the NHL situation, I believe Ms. Gibbons is she's not part of the orchestra, and she's just a person who's got a business that's been impacted through no fault of your own. Ms. Gibbons, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman Atkins, committee members. I appreciate your interest in allowing me to speak today. My name is Claire Gibbons. I founded Claire Gibbons Violins in 1977. For the past 35 years, we have served the needs of the string players in this community. I have 17 employees, seven of whom are violin makers and restorers, four are musicians who are salespeople, and we have six support people. We have a business that was designed to serve the most discriminating players of our community and our region. We have definitely seen the impact of the lockouts on our business. In the past, we would see 10 to 15 of the professional players of the SPCO and the Minnesota Orchestra in our shop weekly. And they would come in to buy strings, to have the sound adjusted on their instruments before an important concert. They might be interested in looking at some of our instruments and bows that we have for sale. Many of the players are teachers, and they are out hunting for good instruments.
softness. One of the things that we do in our shop is we go all over the world to find the best instruments we can in all the various price ranges that our community is interested in acquiring. So we have seen a major impact because of the lack of activity of the professional musicians. We are probably seeing one or two professional musicians every week instead of that 10 to 15. Each one of those musicians would spend somewhere between $50 and $100 every time they came in our shop to have an adjustment done or to buy strings. And so that's down to almost nothing. We're very supportive of our customers and their loyalty, and when the lockouts of both orchestras started and were initiated, we did give every string player a $50 gift certificate to use, and that's just a drop in the bucket of the kind of expenses that are necessary to maintain a fine instrument and a fine bow. And these are ingredients to a fine sound, and it's a sound that is known both orchestras worldwide. So they don't have any of the pressure at this point in time because of the lack of performances to buy new strings or to have their instruments adjusted or to have their bows rehaired. So I suspect just from the orchestra and the lack of business that we're probably down about $25,000, and it's hard to put a finger, you know, just an exact figure forward, but I thought to be more specific would be better than not being specific at all. The other aspect of our loss is the audience members that come in from out of town to hear concerts. So we would see people coming in from all over the region for some of the great concerts. And some of these audience members would be teachers, and they would come in and they would look for instruments for their students, and they would go back to their students with ideas. And we ship across the entire country. So that's not happening anymore. I have no way to put a figure on that. But it's been a major impact. I mean, our business is not going to fail because of it. We're just all working harder and trying to do outreach and expanding our business. But we do definitely feel the impact of the loss of income that our great musicians have had to suffer.
Thank you, Ms. Givens. Yeah, appreciate
welcome.
Your time this
no,
afternoon.
I appreciate
and your
this
testimony.
Opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The last of our single testifiers, and then we're testifying apparently as duets, is Lori Green from Orchestrate Excellence Coalition. Oh, I'm sorry, Lori Greeno. It would help if I would read my sheet fully. Ms. Greeno, welcome to the committee. And I apologize for messing up your name the first time.
No problem. It's an unusual last name, but my husband wouldn't take my last name, so what can you do? All right. Chair Atkins, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for considering the impact of the lockouts on our committee, on our communities, and the state of Minnesota. I'm Lori Greeno, co-chair of Orchestrate Excellence, an independent coalition of over 1,000 community members, donors, and concert goers. In the last few weeks, this group of concerned citizens has formed to give voice to the tremendous economic, educational, and artistic repercussions of the Minnesota Orchestra lockout. On the economic front, the impact of the lockout is significant and far-reaching. According to estimates by Meet Minneapolis, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, visitors who attend classical music concerts spend almost $30 million annually, and much of this revenue will be lost as a result of the Minnesota Orchestra and SPCO lockouts. Already, a single parking facility is reporting a $70,000 shortfall due to concerts canceled to date. The Convention Center, the orchestra's home for this season, has lost over $250,000 in revenue, with a potential of $600,000 lost for the year. One Minneapolis restaurant manager is reporting revenue shortfalls of $3,000 to $10,000 per concert evening, with revenue reductions expected to exceed $100,000 for the 54 Minnesota Orchestra concerts canceled so far. Multiply that times the number of restaurants on South Nicollet Mall, and the shortfall exceeds $1 million for this sector alone. The economic ripple effects of the lockout are perhaps most significant for the countless individuals affected, some of whom we have heard from today in respect to the hockey lockout. but musicians, stagehands, ushers, and others are out of work. Servers are seeing their hours cut. Luthiers, like Mrs. Givens, small businesses that maintain string instruments, report significant revenue shortfalls. The Minnesota Chorale has lost 20% of this year's revenue. Bemidji's community-wide orchestra project for this spring is at risk. And then there is the double whammy effect the lockout has on public funding. Not only are the city, county, and state tax revenues down as a direct result of the lockout, but at the same time, the government is paying thousands of dollars in unemployment every week that the lockout persists. Clearly, the economic impact of this lockout is significant. A thorough analysis by legislative leaders would be very revealing. The lockout is also having a negative impact on the education of Minnesota students as well. In a typical year, the Minnesota Orchestra reaches over 50,000 students. Many of these events have already been canceled, and the public funding spent on them wasted. Spent planning them was wasted. For example, the orchestra was not able to spend 2 days in January with the Osseo Public School children just last week. The Forest Lake School's orchestra residency has been canceled. Students in districts throughout the metro area are waiting to learn whether their orchestra events will be canceled as well. And while impossible to quantify, the artistic impact of the lockout is potentially the most significant long-term repercussion. What we do know is that we have a world-renowned, world-class orchestra that is sitting idle, and a tremendous state asset built over generations by dedicated and far-sighted donors, orchestra board members, corporations, and state officials that is in danger of withering away. We of Orchestrate Excellence, this nascent group of concerned citizens, recognize the significant financial challenges facing the Minnesota Orchestra and understand that a new path must be forged. We believe that it is possible to identify win-win solutions to the current impasse that preserve the world-class orchestra while creating a path to a secure financial future. We encourage management and musicians to end the lockout, to share the facts broadly and transparently, to engage in a productive dialogue, and to engage the broader community to begin to work together to build for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Greeno. That was very helpful. Next is Mark Thosen and Sarah Nagler-Nagley, who I believe wanted to testify together. I don't know if that means you're going to alternate words or how exactly you are anticipating doing that, but I've got you marked as a team on my... Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and representatives, my name is Mark Thosen, and I'm a St. Paul resident. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Save Our St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. We're an audience advocacy group formed to bring another voice to the situation that has taken our beloved orchestra and its world-class music from us. We are not a part of the negotiations, but in the 3 months since our formation, which coincided with the beginning of the lockout, we have taken multiple actions aimed at protecting and supporting the world-class orchestra in the form which we have come to love. We've carefully followed the negotiations as represented by both the musicians and the board of directors of the SPCO. While the musicians have been forthcoming with information from their side of the dispute, we have not received the same reaction from the board at large. 80 of our volunteers personalized letters which we sent to the directors and governors of the board on the first of this year. We delivered a petition to the board with nearly 3,000 signatures on January 8th. We followed with another letter to all those directors and governors signed by our chairwoman, Mary Ellen Jacobson, on January 13th. None of our communications to the large body of governors and directors of the board has been responded to. Let me repeat that. None of our communications has been responded to. Each of them has included our opinion that the very nature and viability of the orchestra is threatened by the current lockout. Not only is the financial pressure of it causing our expert musicians to seek work elsewhere, often outside Minnesota, the lockout prevents the SPCO from providing the community service it was granted nonprofit status to perform. The musicians have even offered to play at drastically reduced wages while continuing to negotiate, but were refused. As an informed group of audience members, we still believe that most of the directors and governors of the board of the SPCO are, in their way, dedicated to the orchestra. Many have donated generously of their wealth and time for years. So as the audience, we look upon the use of this damaging lockout with confusion and frustration. We believe they are being steered in the wrong direction and not given the full picture of what losses have occurred and will occur if the lockout continues. We wish they would write back to us and engage with the audience whom they are charged to serve. We know they miss the music as much as we do. We believe that management is determined to use the stress of this lockout to strip union rights from the musicians, drastically lower their compensation, and reduce the size of the orchestra by initial 20%, attempting to construct a different orchestral model in its place. We conclude that if the society were successful in those aims, the worldwide esteem that the SPCO has built up over 50 years and the orchestra's ability to attract and retain the finest musicians in the world would be damaged beyond repair. The right of labor to strike and the right of a company to lock workers out are always difficult and painful tactics, but both deserve to be protected. However, it is the belief of Save Our SPCO that when the state confers nonprofit status to a corporation, or in any other way supports it with grants or special privileges paid for by public tax revenues, the state and the corporation have a duty to ensure that the benefits to the public are protected as well. We believe that the use of this lockout is an unfair and callous abuse of the trust the state has conferred on the SPCO as a nonprofit entity. Thank you for examining this issue and for giving us the time to air our views.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Representative Atkins, for insisting upon this much-needed hearing. My name is Sarah Nagel, rhymes with bagel. I am secretary of Save Our SPCO, but because I live and work in the Southwest Metro and am a constituent of Representative Hoppe, Joe over there, I would like to focus more on how this lockout has affected me, the Southwest Metro, and the Twin Cities community as a whole. First, we taxpayers are now supporting over 100 talented musicians who are currently drawing unemployment benefits. As far as I know, the SPCO has not laid off many management staff, even though there are no concerts to prepare for and no revenue coming in. This is curious to me. Although these orchestras are legally nonprofits, this action seems to be following the modus operandi of many large corporations to push expenses onto the taxpayers. I want you to know that the effects of this lockout extend beyond the Minneapolis and St. Paul city limits. From Chaska, I have driven to Orchestra Hall for Sublime, Beethoven, and Brahms, and I have gladly driven 40 minutes to the Ordway, and thank you for the new Highway 212, in all kinds of weather. I would often stop to stimulate the economy along the way. The St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, until this fall, also regularly played in 9 neighborhood venues throughout the greater metro area. I've purchased subscriptions at 2 of these locations, Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie and Wyzetta Community Church. What does the lockout mean for the Southwest Metro economic climate? Ticket holders are not going out to dinner before the concert in these areas. And yes, we do have restaurants out there. They are not also making purchases at other nearby businesses. The local churches, which have warmly hosted concerts for many years, are not receiving badly needed extra revenue. And the staff at those locations are not being paid for extra maintenance and other work which would be performed if these concerts were held. In addition, there are quality of life issues which directly impact a community's economic vitality. You may not know that Money Magazine voted Chan Hassen the second best place to live in 2011 and Eden Prairie the third best in 2010, I believe. According to Money, one of the negatives of living in Chanhassen was a lack of nightlife. As a nearby resident, I feel that having a world-class chamber orchestra playing within 15 minutes of my home added immeasurably to the quality of living where I live. And this is not just a cultural, but an economic good. It's something I value. It is of interest to business owners and potential employers and investors and politicians and voters. And unfortunately, the people making a lot of the decisions as to whether residents of the Southwest Metro will be able to attend concerts in their neighborhood seem to know the cost and the price of everything. I hope that they also know the value. As for the future, well, we've heard all sorts of vague statements, but no specifics, except for the fact that the world-class St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, as we know and love it, is in danger of ceasing to exist. The audience has been completely shut out of any discussion. I know of no Management 101 textbook which advocates both destroying the product and disrespecting both present and future customers. Thank you for allowing this hearing to proceed and for listening to the views of constituents, audience members, citizens, and voters.
Thank you, Ms. Nagel. Rhymes with bagel. I was actually asking my committee administrator as you came down, is it Nagel or is it Nagley? So I'm glad we know now, and I'm glad we know that Representative Joe Hoppy rhymes with Poppy is your legislator.
Insert your own joke here. And Mr. Chair, I know we traditionally wait till the end to vote for testifier of the day, but I think I'm ready to cast my vote for favorite testifier.
All in favor, say aye. Thank you, Representative Hoppy. No sucking up going on there. Next up.
No, Mr. Chair, that was clearly sucking up.
As long as we're clear. Final group is Ms. Durand and Mr. Offutt, who've come down from Moorhead. And they may be joined by others. The point of this, and we appreciate their making the long trek down, is that this is not a metro-centric issue. It's easier for people from the metro to get here, but we've had some folks travel a long, long way to share their concerns and thoughts and observations about a lockout that's been going on in the Moorhead area for a long time. Folks, whoever wants to go first, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I have a couple testimonies here from people who could not make it today.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity to share with you all what I've seen and what I know to be happening in my community as a result of the American Crystal Sugar lockout. My name is Heidi Duran. I'm from Moorhead, Minnesota. I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State Community and Technical College. I'm a member of the Minsky Teacher Union. I'm a legislative liaison for our campus. I've been a sociologist for approximately 10, 12 years, however far you want to go back. And I've recently begun my second year as a member of the Moorhead City Council. I've been on various committees in Moorhead, Park Board, Library Board, Public Housing Commission, and I also represent Moorhead in the National League of Minnesota Cities. I was born and raised in the Red River Valley, educated there as well. The town where I grew up in is in the heart of the Red River Valley, part of the sugar beet land. Some of the people I grew up with are now sugar beet farmers, a couple of whom farm my family land. Some of them, people that I grew up with, are now locked out sugar workers. Sadly, my hometown and others in the Red River Valley have become divided. Longtime friends have become enemies. Communities that once enjoyed close unity are now finding their social fabric greatly weakened. This is not because of a religious disagreement. It's not due to a nationwide economic recession that's being felt all over the place. It's not due to a natural disaster. It's due to a man-made and an unnecessary disaster, the Crystal Sugar lockout. August 1st, 2011, okay, not 2012, but 2011, 1,300 workers went to work that day, experienced sugar workers, dedicated sugar workers, to find security guards, supervisors, former friends, telling them all to go home. Their company would not allow them to work. In their place were 1,300 transient workers, workers from out of state that had been hired from a Twin City employment firm. They were, of course, inexperienced. They lacked the long-term commitment to Crystal Sugar that was held and is still held by many Crystal Sugar workers. Transient workers are also cost a lot more to employ than the workers that they replaced. I'd like to make sure that this is clear. The sugar workers did not strike. These men and women wanted to work. They still want to work. They were willing to continue working under the elapsed contract that they had settled several years before. A contract, I really want to emphasize, that said that had a specific no-strike clause, no-strike policy during harvest. And they still were told their services were no longer wanted. 18 months, several contract votes later, the 1,300 workers who had been credited with years of record sugar processing, workers who processed 36% of all sugar beet production in the U.S. are still locked out of their jobs. In the meantime, board members, owners, continue to reap the benefits of their labor as well as the benefits of a protectionist government sugar policy, which controls the amount of cheap foreign-produced sugar coming into our country. The sugar program has obviously been very successful in protecting our domestic sugar industry. Both sugar growers and sugar workers were united together in the fight for the continuation of this policy. But in the meantime, 1,300 workers are still locked out. Most of them are still unemployed. I was asked to speak today not about the personal tragedies of this lockout or the economic devastation being experienced personally by the 1,300 workers and their families. I was asked to talk about the economic consequences it's costing all of us as taxpayers. Most of us here are familiar with the despairing stories from the locked out workers and their families. The family who had to tell their kids they could no longer play hockey because they couldn't afford the fees. The husband who had to tell his wife battling cancer that her treatment might be in jeopardy because they lost their health coverage. The family whose father went on a long drinking binge after being locked out. Or the family who were told their son with cerebral palsy should be signed over as a ward of the state in order to pay for his needs when his health coverage lapsed. What I'd like to talk about is the economic consequences this lockout is having on all of us in Minnesota. What we are failing to discuss are the effects of long-term, massive unemployment on communities. Unemployment inevitably leads to serious difficulties for individuals and their families. We know that. If a job is found, one-third of workers will take a 15 to 20% pay cut. Unemployment insurance payments are 40% less than prior wages. Most of the 1,300 families are relying on $600 to $950 a month compared to the $1,000 to $2,300 a month that they had previously been making. Long-term unemployment can have catastrophic effects. Families are more likely to increase their financial debt, to rely on credit and loans to pay off living expenses. They will see depleted retirement and savings accounts. People tend to drain any type of savings that they may have, and therefore when they are able to retire, their retirement is significantly less, and our Social Security system is not expecting that. We see a tendency of mass relocation from secure housing and increased foreclosures on homes, thereby decreasing overall property value and property tax revenue. We see families lose health insurance. According to the Institute of Medicine, an estimated 20,000 people die in the United States each year due to inadequate health insurance. With a loss of health care coverage, 1,300 workers and their families are less likely to receive preventative care and are more likely to be hospitalized for avoidable problems. 1,300 workers and their families are more likely to have a disease diagnosed later in stages. 1,300 workers and their families are more likely to use emergency rooms because most health care providers do not accept the uninsured. 1,300 workers and their families will be billed at a higher rate for hospital visits because uninsured are always billed at a higher rate. In a U.S. study of families and individuals who have filed bankruptcy, one half of all respondents said medical bills were the main factor in their financial distress. Bankruptcies tend to increase. But that, and that may, to many may seem a personal problem, but it does have huge impacts when we consider who pays for that debt that is written off. Long-term unemployment means 1,300 workers and their families are more likely to forego needed medications. In a U.S. survey of adults, more than one-third said in the past year they did not fill a prescription, they skipped a dose, cut pills in half, all in order to make their meds last longer or to save money. Foregoing medical care and medicine will exacerbate a condition, leading to even higher medical costs. For some of the locked-out workers and their families, medicines that aren't being filled are psychopharmaceuticals. I met a locked-out worker who told me he couldn't afford his medications, so he stopped filling them. When I asked what the meds were for, he said he told me he suffers from severe depression, mood disorder, and anxiety disorder. He told me he took over six different medications that had successfully kept his mental health issues stable for years. I immediately became concerned because we don't have to look too far in our nation's past to see the devastating costs of insufficient mental health treatment for those who need it most. Long-term unemployment also increases the risk of substance abuse and homelessness. I spoke with an individual who told me the day he was locked out, he stopped at a liquor store and has been drunk almost every night since. The community cost of substance abuse could be a whole other topic for discussion. In Moorhead, our homeless shelters have been over capacity since the fall of 2011. Our churches have been asked to open their doors to emergency shelter beds. Our housing assistance waiting list is 5 years out. We have stopped taking names. When an adult wage earner becomes unemployed, other family members often feel compelled to look and take job or increase their hours. Sometimes those family members are teenagers. When a teenager is asked to find a job in order to help their family stay afloat, the focus on education becomes lost. Their grades suffer, and many will drop out. I don't think I have the time to go into the economic ramifications of high school dropouts, but I can tell you that dropouts are more likely to be unemployed, have lower incomes, suffer poorer health, have higher rates of criminal behavior, and have higher use of government services such as welfare and medical assistance. So people who remove themselves from this lockout because it doesn't affect them need to know that it does. And governments not getting involved because it interferes with capitalism and free enterprise, it is having a negative impact on businesses and commerce in the Red River Valley. My question, then, for those who remove themselves is, if this is not an economic concern for all of us, who is going to pay for the consequences I just mentioned, not to mention the ones I may have forgot? Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Rand.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, representatives. I'm Jeff Offit. I teach world history to eighth graders up in Moorhead. It's my role in the community as a teacher that brings me before you today. I'm here to give voice to the students who have been and are continuing to be affected by Crystal Sugar's lockout of its union workers, workers who want to be working, who want to be supporting their family. When the folks who research educational best practices are asked, what's the most important factor for a student's education, we're told it's the family, supportive parents. We're dealing with a situation with kids who have one, sometimes two parents who are locked out of their jobs. They don't have the stability that kids rely on. They rely on so thoroughly, they don't even locked out of their jobs. They don't have the stability that kids rely on. They rely on so thoroughly, they don't even think about it until the stability's gone. They don't think about it, but they rely on it. I teach all kinds of lessons on ancient Egypt and the foundations of civilizations, but not all the kids are focused on the lessons. Teachers now have kids in class thinking, what's my dad going to be doing today? Is mom going to be able to put food on the table tonight? They're thinking about this past Christmas and the Christmas before that and wondering what next Christmas is going to look like. The 18 months that this lockout has been going on gives kids a lot to think about. They aren't giving their full attention to their lessons. I can't blame them. They have a lot of very adult things on their minds. Rather than wondering why their parent is no longer wanted by Crystal Sugar, they should be considering the importance of river water to Indus River Valley civilizations as they're developing. If they are a bit off task during class, they should be thinking about basketball, which, by the way, at $65 for middle school students and $180 for high school students, is no longer an option for some of those kids. Keeping men and women from the jobs definitely affects workers, and those workers have families. Some have kids. It's one of the things that people don't generally think about when they think about lockouts. They think you've got the workers, you've got management, but those workers are caught up in the lockout. The ripples of this tactic go out a long way. The impact is tremendous. I've talked with teachers who have told me about kids that worry about having to move so mom and dad can get another job. Some teachers have talked about students under so much stress that it's having negative effects on their health. I spoke with a high school girl whose father has been locked out of her job, who wants to be working. Like many teenagers, she wants a new pair of pants. She wants a new pair of shoes. But her dad's locked out, and those things are going to have to wait. I understand that it's somebody's job to watch the bottom line. Meat growing and sugar production is a business. I get that. But what about the kids that are suffering from this lockout? What can we do to look out for them? Thank you for your attention to this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Offit.
Hello, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to let me tell you how American Crystal Sugar has hurt me with their lockout. My name is Becky Jacobson, and I live in Moorhead, Minnesota. My father worked for American Crystal Sugar for 37 years, and my grandpa worked there before him. As a child, I remember my dad coming home from work and hanging his smelly clothes in the basement, and I would always swear to myself that I will never work there just because of that smell. But later, when I graduated from high school, I decided to go there, work for a year, save some money, go to college. It didn't take me long before I realized that the smell of my dad's clothes was actually the smell of money. I was locked out of American Crystal Sugar on August 1st, 2011, after 30 years of dedicated service. I didn't ask to be locked out. I love my job, and I was very good at my job. We were all good at our jobs, so good that we continuously broke records for the last 5 years. We basically gave the company 5 Super Bowl rings, or maybe I should say 5 Stanley Cups. And they traded us all the best players in for 1,300, that might be nice and call them replacement workers, that have no clue what they're doing. 1,300 of us. We were willing to work under our old contract until a new one could be ratified, but instead we were told there was no work for us to do. We were escorted out of the factories as the replacement workers were being bussed in. I made enough money to pay the bills, raise my kids as a single parent, and have a little extra. I like to support the economy, keep the economy going. I bought local, but the replacement workers that Crystal Sugar hired came from all over the United States, and they sent their paychecks home. They didn't spend them here in the community. Most of them were ex-cons hired from Strum Engineering, a union-busting company out of Minnetonka. Many have a long rap sheet. Some have been arrested in our communities in the Red River Valley for armed robbery and drug dealing. This is what American Crystal Sugar brought into our communities. The CEO gave himself a $500,000 raise as he kicked us to the curb. I couldn't even afford Christmas presents for my granddaughter this year because my unemployment ran out. My unemployment only covered half of my wages, but it was enough to get by. I've applied for over 50 jobs since the lockout began, only to be turned down by all of them because they're all afraid that they don't want to spend the money and time into training me, only for me to go back to Crystal Sugar when the lockout ends. Well, it's been 18 months and I still don't have a job. I did work for the United States Post Office for 3 months, but then was terminated as I became diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and neuropathy. and I had to miss work for doctor appointments. With no health insurance anymore, I now have medical bills that are mounting up that I cannot afford to pay. I just finished a two-week job with a temp agency working in a college bookstore. I really don't have any experience other than working in a factory setting, so I'm really not considered qualified in many of the jobs that are available in my area. I was also just diagnosed with severe depression, and now I can't afford the five medications that I am now taking. I'll probably have to quit taking them. I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills. I don't know where my next meal is going to come from. This lockout has destroyed families, relationships, communities. Some of my coworkers have lost their houses. A lot of them have been forced to take early retirement just so they have some type of income to live off. Many of them are both husband and wife, so there's two incomes they don't have. I know a lot of people that have had to file bankruptcy or sell everything they work so hard for just to keep their families fed. I know this because I had to sell my snowmobile just so I can make a house payment. I don't want to lose my house. I think that Crystal Sugar should be responsible to continue paying for my unemployment benefits until this unnecessary lockout ends, as they are the reason I am not working. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We appreciate the folks joining us to testify. I appreciate the patience of our members. At least for me, this has been challenging to listen to. And normally we have a good reputation in this committee of finishing on time at 5:30. We're not going to do that tonight. And my apologies to members. For our inability to do that. I thought about switching things around and not doing this hearing relative to lockouts, and doing the health insurance exchange that we moved or carried over from yesterday to today. In light of the testimony that we've heard, I'm awfully glad that we did not do that, and I appreciate the courtesies and the patience of our members in hearing what I consider to be very important testimony, and I hope you do too. As I looked around the room, as we heard of some of the testimony that was given, there were tears in people's eyes as they heard about the devastating effects, and thank you particularly to the folks from Moorhead that drove so long to be here, or to get here, but to everyone that joined us for this discussion. There is legislation that's being contemplated in order to perhaps try to prevent or disincentivize the probability of lockouts. We'll save that for another day, but this was, I think, a very helpful hearing in presenting a picture not just of what's happening in the metro area, but across Minnesota, the epidemic of lockout efforts that are taking place, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. We will take a couple-minute break, and by that I just, and it's mostly to let folks that aren't here for the health insurance exchange discussion allow you to move out of the room, let folks get a drink of water. We literally will start that discussion back up at 5:35, so that's a seven-minute break. And again, my appreciation to members for your patience. We will now take a recess and come back with the health insurance marketplace bill, House File Number 5. Thank you.
Members, if you want to take your places, we are off recess and we are back to the committee process. Representative Atkins, welcome to your committee.
Well, Madam Chair, before we get going on this bill, it's 5:36. We're past our committee time. We went overtime last night. We went overtime on the preliminary event this evening. I think in fairness to committee members and to the people that are here, rather than keep people here extended hours into the evening, I think we should take this bill and table it again and give it a proper committee hearing on Tuesday.
Well, Representative Hoppe, obviously you have never worked or served on Health and Human Services. We go all night sometimes into the wee hours of the morning.
With all due respect, Madam Chair, this is the Commerce Committee, and I don't care what Health and Human Services does.
Well, I understand your concerns, but it's still early. We still have time to discuss this bill before us, and I appreciate your concerns. But I think if we all just roll our sleeves up and get to work here right now, we can get on with it. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I understand that we now have your bill, House File 5, before us, and we have one testifier who did not have a chance to speak yesterday, and he has a short three-minute testimony that he would like to give to the committee now. Mr. Stephen Elfin, Ellen, would you please come to the table and introduce yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House. I was here last night and wasn't able to get on the schedule, so I'll make this brief. I am an independent insurance agent from up in St. Cloud. I have testified in front of the House and Senate numerous times for other insurance-related issues. One of the things that really concerns me about this bill and the state of Minnesota participating in the Nationalized Health Exchange or the Minnesota Exchange is it goes far beyond just being able to enroll people for health insurance. The major concern that I would have is the exchange of all of the private and personal information, and that it's a way to house all of that data. Now, once the state of Minnesota has already taken a bite of that forbidden fruit and has already accepted over $110 million in order to just create this animal that will cost over $50 million a year, I would like to just let you know that as a private agent, for years, we have a private health exchange, and this costs me $35 a month. It's as simple as anyone that wants insurance. They go in, they put in their age, if they're a tobacco user or not, their spouse's age, if they use tobacco, and how many children they have. Hit the submit button. Every insurance product that's available in the state of Minnesota is pulled up. It can be easily sorted by plan type that they want, whether popular plans, traditional plans, health savings account plans, copay plans, short-term medical plans. They're all available, as well as with the private agent's information, which I frequently get calls from people, and I walk them through the process and give them their options. I highly doubt that creating a Minnesota health exchange, number one, is going to save money, because to me, I don't see how we're going to save money spending that amount of money. And number two, start insuring what we call the uninsured or this uninsured crisis that we say we have. Because the majority of the current uninsured do qualify for Minnesota Care, Medicaid, and the state has fallen or failed to insure those people from the county level to the state level. So creating an exchange is not going to solve that problem. But I guess that, you know, as an agent and as four agents, we don't deal with that population, nor can we, because it's at the county level. And what we have done is through the agent coalition, through years and years of work, in this last year, we were able to participate in the Healthy Minnesota program, which 4,100 Minnesota recipients of Minnesota Care were supposed to be able to participate with a voucher program that they could go into the private insurance market. That did not happen the way it was supposed to. I received one phone call from a woman that she got her letter and qualified. Through three conversations with her and getting her enrolled in the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, her initial conversation was she was terrified that she was going to be coming off of the Minnesota Care program and fearful that she wouldn't be able to get insurance due to pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. I immediately relieved her of that concern and let her know in the state of Minnesota we do have the high-risk pool. So in the state of Minnesota, we currently have a wonderful system, and people that have pre-existing conditions do have access to care. And I would be an advocate of, instead of wasting all this money in a health insurance exchange, let's focus some of these dollars towards getting them funneled to people that are truly in need or are uninsured, and let them use those dollars to go provide them to get coverage in the private market. But currently they aren't getting coverage, and it's available to them through the government access, but they don't get it. So I don't see how creating this big animal is going to now get coverage for those people that currently have access to care. And as I had stated, my main concern is all of the data that's going to be going into this thing and being housed in one place, I don't feel is a good thing for the citizens of Minnesota to be forced into that type of a system.
Well, we appreciate you coming back, Mr. Elfman. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you.
Representative Atkins, would you like us to proceed then with questions from the members?
I would. Madam Chair, I believe it's appropriate for me to renew my motion at this time.
Yes.
As we laid the bill over to today. So I'd renew my motion that House File 5 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Government Operations. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hoppe.
And Madam Chair, if I might, and I'm sorry, Representative Hoppe, I've got April Todd Malmov from the Exchange, and I believe she's here.
Yes, there she is. Good. Come to the table.
I'm going to ask her to join me as well. I believe that I'm capable of answering any question that's posed. I believe that Ms. Todd Malmov is able to answer any question that's posed more succinctly and perhaps a little bit more accurately, but I'm going to do my best to answer all the questions that people may have.
But thank you, Representative, and welcome to the committee. We're happy to have you both here this evening. So we'll start with a question from Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question for Michelle Kimball from AARP.
Okay. And is Michelle Kimball in the audience? If she is, would she please come down?
Madam Chair, I hope with all due respect that we're not going to see a parade of people that testified last night that are not going to be here to answer questions today.
Well, I hope that they do come. So, we asked them to return, and I believe we do have someone from AARP, but is that you, Ms. George?
Well, I could.
That is you.
Yes,
please.
Okay.
Introduce yourself and who you represent, please, for the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Jo George, and I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP, and unfortunately, Michelle could not be here tonight, but hopefully I could answer the question. Otherwise, if not, we will get back to you.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm wondering, when this bill passes, what is AARP, what is your role, your organization's role, going to be in the healthcare exchange?
Representative Hoppe, members of the committee, AARP does not sell insurance, so it is my understanding that we will not have any products that AARP does not sell insurance. We do offer a sort of good housekeeping seal of approval on different Medicare Part D products, but we do not stand to benefit financially from the development of the exchange.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will AARP have navigators?
Representative Hoppe, Madam Chair, no. It is not our intention to apply for navigators. We do feel, as part of our mission, that we will want to do some education and outreach on the Affordable Care Act and the exchange, but we would not be interested in applying for a navigator grant.
Thank you.
Hoppe.
Madam Chair, I had a chair for a question, rather, for Ms. Doyle from Take Action Minnesota.
And Ms. Doyle, are the Take Action Minnesota folks here this evening? There we go. Thank you, Ms. George.
Ms. Doyle is not here. I'm Sarah Greenfield from Take Action Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Representative Hoppe, would you post your question?
Madam Chair, I had questions for the people that testified last night. I'll go ahead and ask them. I don't know if I would get the same answers, but I'll ask. What will Take Action Minnesota's role be after this bill passes?
Ms. Doyle.
Ms. Greenfield.
Sorry.
Madam
Thank
Chair. In terms of, could you be more specific? I just want to make sure that I'm able to accurately answer your question.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, Madam Chair, it's hard to ask this question because the Ms. Doyle that was here last night said that they would be safeguarding and shepherding people, and that she wanted to make sure that things were free of financial conflicts of interest. And any entity that also sells will be biased. And what I'm wondering is, what's the role of Take Action Minnesota going to be when this passes?
So, Madam Chair, Representative, in response to that question, we do not sell insurance products, nor will we. We do not have an intention to be navigators. So our role is as an organizing and a grassroots organizing and advocacy organization to make sure that there's a people's voice in the process, and that would continue.
So, Madam Chair, a follow-up question. Then I would assume you'd be concerned about navigators for any other organization that are out there, because they're out there and they have a financial conflict of interest. So are you then going to have a problem? Is your organization going to have a problem with the whole navigator concept?
Testifier, please.
I mean, there was testimony last night from someone else from this organization that was almost accusatory about people that had a financial conflict of interest. In other words, apparently just the agents and brokers.
Would you care to comment, Ms. Greenfield?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. The testimony from our organization regarding a financial conflict of interest was regarding a concern that entities that might be paid for enrolling people in particular plans and not in others, that presents a conflict of interest, whether those plans are paid differently inside or outside the exchange or by different carriers, and that would not be the case for the Navigator program as designed.
Representative Hoppe.
So, Madam Chair, maybe I'm missing something here, but so navigators won't be compensated at all for the service that they're providing?
Ms. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, Representative, they will be compensated. They would be compensated, and again, some of these decisions are made locally and some federally, but the federal law does designate that navigators would be compensated by the exchange, and so they would not be compensated differently they would not have an incentive to steer people outside of the exchange or to one carrier over another, for example.
Well, Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, so then they would have a financial incentive. They're going to be compensated or rewarded for navigating people onto the exchange.
Ms. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, Representative, they would, it is my understanding, they would have an incentive to help people select and initiate enrollment in coverage, which I would perceive as a duty, not a conflict of interest.
Well,
Representative Hoppe.
One other question then, the last question for me for Take Action. Will Take Action Minnesota have a presence on the Healthcare Exchange Board?
I'm not able to answer that question. I don't anticipate that we would.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for your questions. Anyone else? Yes, Mr. Woodard, Representative Woodard.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question about the exchange itself. I'm a little confused by what exactly it is. It's not exactly clear in the bill. What sort of data, let me start off with that, what sort of data would be housed in the exchange, and how would it be shared and with whom?
Representative Woodard, thank you for your question, and would Ms. Malmla go ahead and answer that if you would?
Please. So in response to your question about data, so really the data and the information that the exchange would be utilizing is really up to the consumer in terms of what they want their interaction to be. So if they want to go to the exchange and they just want to browse plans, no information is going to be collected at all nor asked for. They can browse whatever plans are available on the exchange. If they, however, are looking for financial assistance, so for tax credits, for eligibility for Medicaid, some other information will be asked to verify their identity and to verify their income. That information, before that is asked, they would be given a Tennyson warning and said, this is the type of information that we will be asking you. You know, if you do not want financial assistance or to be determined eligible for Medicaid, you know, stop at this time. But in order to really protect the use of public funds, need to ensure that people are eligible for what it is that they are applying for.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is this a compliance function then? So this will determine whether or not the user is compliant with the ACA. And if they do decide to go through the Tennyson warning, what entities is that information shared with?
Ms. Baumwalt.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the information can come from a variety of different sources. So first, information to determine eligibility for income. There's a first source of income information from the federal tax system. And so they'll, with permission of the consumer, access that tax information. Does this represent your income? There's also the ability to look at deed records as well for quarterly wage filings through the Department of Economic Employment Development.
Representative Woodard, does that answer your question?
Not yet.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Keep going.
So there's two organizations that would have access outside. Well, DEED obviously is a Minnesota organization, and then the IRS. So those are the only two organizations that this information would be shared with?
Ms. Mamla.
Madam Chair and Representative, so that was information pertaining to income information. Okay. There's other information pertaining to eligibility related to citizenship and lawful presence. That information would also be available in the federal hub that would come from the Social Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that those eligible are either citizens or lawfully present.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if let's go down that line for a minute. So if you are an illegal citizen, will that then be a compliance issue as you put that information in and Department of Homeland Security determines that you are not a legal citizen and not eligible for this? Is there a compliance associated with that? Would that be a way to identify illegal aliens in the country?
Ms. Mama.
Madam Chair and Representative, what do you mean sure. by compliance? I'm not fully understanding that question.
Madam Chair, you mentioned that the Department of Homeland Security would have access to this to determine eligibility, as in, are you a citizen and eligible for this? So if the Department of Homeland Security determines you are not a citizen, is that then, from a compliance standpoint, something the Department of Homeland Security would have the ability to act upon and say, you are not a legal citizen and now you are in violation of law and we know who you are?
Ms. Mamla.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of how the Department of Homeland Security would use that information. My background here is just literally around eligibility for that assistance through the exchange.
So, thank you. Madam Chair, so we're asked to vote on a bill where we're not sure where this data is going and how it will be used. You're interested in the eligibility piece as far as the income eligibility, but we don't know how the Department of Homeland Security would use this information? And whether they would be able to use it or not, and in what manner?
Yes, Ms.
Madam
Mama,
Chair, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
And I appreciate this line of inquiry, mm-hmm. And I also want to have a good, thoughtful, and thorough hearing of the bill. Mm-hmm. But one of the stops that we're going to make I don't know, Representative Woodard, if you're on civil law committee or not, but I expect that the data practices mm-hmm. element of this will be as well as probably in perhaps government operations. But it'll be thoroughly voiced or ventured into there as well.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, then a different line of questioning, and I would certainly hope the answer is ready for civil law, because I would imagine that those lawyers, as you and I both have been through that committee, are going to ask a lot tougher questions than I am about that, so I appreciate that. The second line of question I had was, we just heard testimony of an exchange, and I've been on the AARP site as well, and they've got a product knowledge, product finder, that appears to be a lot of a travelocity, if you will, form of an exchange. And we heard testimony that for $35 a month, another exchange, it's not going to go into compliance, doesn't go to the Department of Homeland Security to determine whether you're a citizen or not. Where is all this money going? I know we don't have a fiscal note, so we're not quite sure where that money comes up with. But we're talking about $54 million in the first year, and I think another $67 in the second year. What exactly is this exchange going to do if we can build a website that's significantly cheaper than that? And I'm aware of Utah having a similar Travelocity, again, kind of exchange that was about $600,000 for them to implement. That's a significant difference. So what exactly is the exchange going to do with that money?
Ms. Mamla.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you should have in your packets an outline here of the budget of kind of what the grant funds have been applied for. To date, what we've received them for. There's a variety of detailed information in here in terms of the contracts, the hardware, the software that's that's contained in building the exchange. What I'd say is that the exchange is not just simply a website. There's a variety of component pieces that of functionality that performs. As I was mentioning earlier, it does have an eligibility determination system. So it is replacing a 25-year-old system, eligibility determination system for medical assistance. It's also determining eligibility for tax credits. It needs to operate a call center and provide in-person, online, phone, mail, fax assistance and eligibility determinations. Also needs to operate a navigator program. Needs to provide for appeals. So it provides a variety of provides functionality beyond just a website.
President Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if it's doing all those functions, I guess I'm confused by what a navigator does then.
Ms. Malmwood.
Madam Chair and Representative, a navigator is for those people that would like in-person assistance to help them work, go through the eligibility process, to help them enroll in a plan. That's in-person assistance that is available to them. A navigator is also there to provide on-the-ground outreach and education around what the exchange is and what assistance they may be eligible for.
Representative Woodard.
Okay, so that is, thank you, Madam Chair, and that's in addition to all the roles of the 72 people that are, or 70 plus people that you have in the budget. The navigators are in addition to that and performing that function beyond those 70 plus people. Is that correct?
Ms. Momla?
Madam Chair and Representative, the navigators are would be individuals and organizations that the exchange would provide grants or other compensation to provide on-the-ground in-person assistance to individuals. Not included in the FTE count that is in.
Okay.
Representative Woodard?
So thank you, Madam Chair. And so how many additional people is that?
Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, you're asking about how many navigators that would need to be?
Right.
At this time, we haven't worked through the level of how many navigators would need to be in each particular area that is there.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So based on that, how do we know what the budget is?
Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have looked at some assistance estimates that other states have had and some consultant costs around essentially based on the enrollment numbers, how many people would need assistance to enroll. We haven't equated that to how many navigator people that would actually be, but how many people would need how many people would need assistance out of those projected to enroll.
Representative Woody.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I guess I'm confused by that answer. So, you know how many people will need to be served, you know what the population is, you know what the roles are, you've described the roles, but we're not sure how many people that is and what the budget would be?
Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have enrollment estimates of those that would enroll in the exchange and some estimates of how many of those people would potentially need in-person assistance. We have not calculated that out to how many navigator individuals that would equate to.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll let a few other members ask some questions. I know they have some similar questions.
Well,
but
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your questions. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the author of the bill, or Ms. Malmov, so the 100, and I was looking through your spreadsheet, but the $109 million that we used to build this website or additional website plus navigators, the federal system is also either supposedly being built or underway. Was there any collaboration? Did you take any best practices off of that federal or any of the other states that have been doing this in order to save money, or did we just bring everybody into Minnesota because we had $110 million to spend?
Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have been working collaboratively with the federal government, and in particular have been working very collaboratively with the state of Maryland. They have the same IT vendors that we are using, and so in every instance that we can utilize the same functionality, we are doing so.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you could show us those cost savings or you know, a memo or a briefing on that as to where, because I find $110 million to build a website or a little bit more website plus navigators, even though we don't know how many navigators yet, is in most terms, to quote my colleague who's no longer here, that's a lot of money. And the fact that not only, I mean, you're exempt from all kinds of things, which I'm sure we'll get into later on down here. But back to the navigator question. Again, we have a defined population, and we don't have the study yet, which apparently we're going to get before we have a vote. And any member who doesn't have that before we vote, I would highly discourage, because this Gorman or whoever the study is that we've been promised for days and weeks and months has not gotten here yet. But what is the population that you're defining as uninsured, insurable, but has not chosen to take coverage yet? Percentages, numbers, because we've got some pie charts that we've seen that show a number, but I'm just curious as to what your numbers are.
Madam Chair, if I might just interject briefly. I just, Representative Zellers, I appreciate your comments. I just wanted to make sure for members' edification that they take a look at it's my own fault yesterday. There's a lot of folks that have commented about this is just Travelocity for health insurance. It's far more involved in that. And I appreciate the right that Representative Zellers has to say what he says. I would point you to the, and this is as brief as we could put it, it's five pages of legal print about all that's been involved in getting to this date and the use of the funding. There's also fiscal notes coming in terms of demonstrating what the purpose and how the function of the marketplace will work. Moreover, it's I don't want to say insulting or demeaning, but for the agents and brokers that are out there that sell this product and the navigators that are going to help with it, if it was just Travelocity, I can sit down and buy an airline ticket, Representative Zellers. The agents and brokers and navigators who are going to assist in this effort, there is a very critical role for those folks to play because health insurance is a complicated product for businesses, for individuals, for entrepreneurs. And I made the mistake, and I'll own up to it. When we first talked about this a year ago, I called it Travelocity for health insurance. And since then, in the year, I found out it's a heck of a lot more than that. With that, Madam Chair, I apologize for interrupting, but I'll turn it over to Ms. Malmo to answer that question.
Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins, I would agree with you, but we had an agent come up here and in 5 minutes' time show a half a dozen different ways where we could get insurance. And he pays $38 or $35 or how many dollars a month it is for that product, and we're spending $110 million to build this thing, and on top of it, $50-some million every year to run it, and we don't know how many navigators we're going to need to go out and find people. We haven't even gotten into the budget, why everybody's unclassified, why the salary of the director is going to be more than the governor's making. I mean, this is so actually, I think you were right, and you shouldn't apologize, because again, an agent was able to show us here with his iPad how to find health insurance coverage for most Minnesotans that want it but are choosing not to get it in 5 minutes' time, and we spent $110 million, and I think we're only getting to the basics of, at the end of the day, are we going to insure more people, and are we going to save average Minnesotans on their health care insurance? I've yet to hear the answer is yes and yes, but I remain, I remain willing to be proven wrong, but so far what we've seen, I don't think it's going to happen. But to your question,
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, yes and yes. I'd invite Ms. Malmov to walk it. There's a distinct difference between what we can do right now as far as sitting down and looking for health insurance online and what the marketplace is that we're establishing here. And I appreciate you bringing that point up, because it's distinctly different. And I would, if it's all right with you, you've obviously got the floor. But I think it bears noting, there was a gentleman that came all the way from St. Cloud to show us that. And it's a critical point, that there's a key distinction between what you can currently do and what this device and opportunity will allow for. Ms. Malmo?
Ms. Malmo. Madam Chair, Representative. So, as I was mentioning previously, this is not just a website. This will be determining eligibility for public assistance, both for medical assistance and for the premium tax credits. That eligibility system is replacing a very old system that we have in Minnesota today, over 25 years old. So it does that. It also provides access to comparable information, apples to apples comparative information on cost, quality, and customer satisfaction, not separate sources of information on that from each different carrier. So comparable across all carriers, the same level of information. It will also be providing a call center so that anyone can call that needs assistance can get assistance through that mechanism. We also need to be able to determine eligibility through that phone system as well, which is something that we do not do today. Also need to provide in-person assistance for individuals, whether that is through a navigator or through a broker, someone that can help them find information and enroll in the plan that is best for them. That in-person assistance, they need to be able to determine eligibility through in-person assistance as well as through mail and fax. So those systems are those that do not operate today. We also need to operate an appeals system. An appeals for eligibility determinations, where someone, if we determine that someone's not eligible and they think that they are eligible, we also need to process appeals as well. So it is much more than just a simple website for people to find what coverage is available.
Representative Sellers.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and it's my fault for deviating away because that's had nothing to do with the question I asked. But
you're on to me, Representative Sellers.
Yeah, well, you're a lawyer. It's your job. The Ms. Melmov, you said that that would be to look over all of the carriers then and to provide comparison, but all of the carriers that are approved by the exchange. So if you're not approved by the exchange, then you don't get to be in part of the comparison. Yes or no?
Ms. Melmov.
What?
Or Representative Atkins.
If you're not a Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, I think it was addressed to Ms. Malov, but the answer is if you're not approved, if you don't meet the certification requirements, the answer is no, or if you don't sell your product.
Representative
right,
Zellers.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative Atkins or Ms. Malov, or if the exchange doesn't approve you, so you could qualify but still not be approved by the exchange, correct?
Ms. Representative Atkins?
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Zellers, you've identified a fine point, and that is whether this has an active purchaser role or something akin to what people have labeled an active purchaser role or not. And the answer is, under the current draft of the legislation, you would need to meet a certain bar to be eligible, and then there would be an active purchaser element where the board would have an opportunity to further negotiate with those plans to try to find the highest quality, most affordable, best-fitting products.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the short answer is yes. Some of those folks could be some of the carriers, even though they go through the qualification process. And I think that it's not just a point, it's a critical flaw in the bill, one of many. But Ms. Melmoff, my question was back again to that defined group. So what you're defining as the population that is uninsured or has chosen not to take coverage for personal reasons, financial reasons, their live free and die types that just don't want insurance and don't want anybody to know their data. So the population that we're talking about was the original question before we kind of drifted afar.
Ms. Baumwald.
Madam Chair, Representative, so to your question of kind of who would participate in the exchange and the uninsured that are left and who participates, so I'm going to reference some results that we had presented from the Gruber-Gorman study. The results are available. They're up on our website. Predicting 1.3 million people would participate in the exchange. Of those 1.3 million people, roughly 700,000 of them would be getting eligibility for medical assistance determined through the exchange. Of the roughly 600,000 that are left, about 450,000 of those would be individual consumers. Of those 450,000 individuals, 370,000 of them are eligible for the premium tax credits. 150,000 would be employees of small groups. Of those, about a fifth of those, or a little over 30,000, would be eligible for the small business tax credits.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you're down to about 370,000 of the, and the percentage of uninsured is about 8% then, is what the overall of the total population from, if I'm getting your numbers right with the numbers that I have.
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the uninsured that exists today is roughly around 500,000 individuals. It's about 9% of Minnesota's population. Under the changes under the ACA and the assistance that's there, the projections by Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman are that the uninsured would be reduced by 300,000 individuals, which would leave 200,000 individuals in Minnesota uninsured.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and Chairman Atkins has assured us that we'll get the Bell and Gorman study. And as somebody who deals in a business of data and polling data, the devil is always in the detail. So I would assume the Chair has promised us, but Madam Chair and the author of the bill that we'll see all of the details, not just the few highlights that suit our case on a website later on. The other question I had, Madam Chair, and I'll pass for a while, is on the 2 to 3.5%. So if I heard Ms. Melmoff correctly, is we're using the healthcare exchange as a way to update equipment from other agencies then, that the system that we have that's antiquated, we're using the health exchange and this 3.5%, call it a premium or fee or tax, I'll call it a tax, but you're using the 3.5% tax to update old equipment instead of being honest and coming before the committee and those marathon sessions in the health committee to actually do it there. We're using this as an excuse or a way to pay for these updated systems through the health exchange.
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, the development cost of the exchange, so the development of the system, is paid for primarily through federal funds, through grant funds coming in 2013 to cover the cost of the development of that system. What the ACA requires is that there's a streamlined eligibility system, both for medical assistance and for the premium tax credits. This creates one system that will determine Medicaid eligibility and premium tax credits through one mechanism instead of two separate mechanisms. So it does provide the opportunity for us to upgrade those systems under federal funds.
Representative Zellers.
I'm not sure I got the answer to my question there, Madam Chair. So the streamlining process is for the qualifications, but what you said was we have equipment that's 25 years old that we're updating. So which is it? Are we using this as an excuse to update? And just because it's federal funds, it's still our money. I mean, no offense, but it's the money from Washington isn't free and doesn't, although they do print it in the basement there, but that's still our money. So are we really using these federal dollars to update an antiquated system, as you stated, or are we using it to provide this new fast, super fast qualification system or pre-qualifying system?
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, the funds are being used for both. It's being used to upgrade an eligibility system for Medicaid and to provide the functionality under the exchange related to eligibility, comparative information, all of the IT system that's there. This provides us an opportunity to do this cost effectively through one mechanism instead of having two different systems determining eligibility.
So the answer is yes, Madam Chair. I'll pass for a while. Thank you.
Right. And we are to Representative Loon.
Next. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll throw this out to whoever wants to answer it. And mine maybe are a little more elemental questions about how this all will operate, but maybe first to Chairman Atkins, and if my question gets to comments that you made yesterday and then also to AARP, so if they want to come down and chime in, that's whatever works. But in your opening remarks yesterday about your bill, you talked about a competitive and a robust marketplace that will be developed through the exchange. And then there were comments made from AARP and that about having a manageable number of choices. So, you know, I'm not quite squaring that. And can you give me an example of what you have in mind? Or, I mean, for some people, robust might be 100. Maybe manageable is 5. I mean, what are you envisioning or what do you think we could expect from this?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Loon. I think that's a terrific question. I honestly don't know. I am hoping for a very competitive, robust, vibrant, competitive marketplace where just a simple fellow like me with a little law firm can go on and get products that fit our needs, quality products at a reasonable price where we get an apples-to-apples comparison. So long as, whether that's 10 products or 75 products, I don't know that there's a magic number per se as much as it is. We just want to make sure that there's an active level of competition. I don't want to put words in the mouth of the AARP folks, so I won't venture what they may have an entirely different number. What I've heard from the plans, who can also speak for themselves, is that they don't anticipate that this is going to be a Part D with thousands or, you know, all sorts of products like that, that it'll be a more manageable number so that you're not having to shop in a grocery store full of 10,000 items, but a little bit more manageable number. And again, they can speak for themselves as well.
Representative Lewin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And, well, Representative Atkins, just to pursue that a little further, I mean, is there a number that you would consider a minimum number of products for the exchange? I mean, as the author of the bill, you must have some kind of vision for this.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Lewin, one really good one for me. I think that number may vary for different people. I don't have any particular number in mind. Mm. I just want to make certain that there are enough products that the purchasing public and businesses and entrepreneurs can find something that fits their needs. That may be 10, it may be 50, it may be 100. It is definitely more than the one that just fits my needs.
Representative Lewin.
Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you, okay. Madam Chair. Did AARP want to comment on what they would consider a manageable number?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George again, mm-hmm. for the record. Representative Lewin, I would agree with Representative Atkins. We probably have not, you know, said we think a certain number is appropriate, so we have not defined an actual number with manageable. I think our experience from the rollout of Part D was that there were so many plans that it was confusing for consumers, and that was, you know, over 140. It has now been streamlined to be, you know, around 60. I know from, you know, the federal employees, let's, for example, the federal employee health benefit plan, I think employees have like 17 different options to choose from. But I also think you have to realize in the ACA, there's different tiers that consumers will have. There's four different tiers, so we imagine that there's going to be a number of products in each of the tiers. But so no definite number, but just not so many that it almost becomes paralyzing. I guess that's what we're after. I think sometimes if consumers, we think if they have too much choice, it actually is really no choice at all, because they can't make decisions very effectively. So I don't know if that completely got at your answer, but
Representative Lewin. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel that way about cars. I hate car shopping. Yeah. But, you know, we don't limit that necessarily, and that may be it's a big purchase and a large financial commitment on a part of a consumer. But I just was trying to get some idea here about, you know, where the vision is for a robust marketplace, but a manageable marketplace, and that. But I thank you for your comments. Madam Chair, if I could move on to another question I had, and this was more to the navigators and the in-person assisters for the exchange, and again to whoever would like to respond. I didn't see any specifics, and I may have missed this, but in the legislation with regards to what kind of training, or whether it's educational background or specific training, because obviously once the products for the exchange have been determined, they're going to have to be experts at helping people with their personal situations and walking through these products. So what kind of training are these people going to have, and who will do that?
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, so there is a variety of different levels of training that would need to occur for the Navigator program. First, there will need to be training on just the how the tool works, how to inform people of information that is there. They'll also need to have training on privacy and security of information, particularly for those that are going to be wanting to be determined eligible for public assistance. They'll also need to have training on conflict of interest, on the roles that they can and cannot provide. There's a variety of types of information that they will need to be trained on, including those as examples. For the committee, that, you know, if they want a detailed list of that, we do have a Navigator and Agent Broker work group that went through some of the details of the training that would need to occur for navigators, and information that brokers would need to be trained on as well, that we could provide the committee.
Representative Loon.
And thank you, Ms. Mumlov. And so is that, I think I heard you say earlier in response that that would be done through grants perhaps to organizations that would be either sponsoring or providing navigators, so with their training would come through those organizations and grants provided, or where there'll be staff on the exchange that will be doing this training?
Madam Chair and Representative, there's a variety of ways that this training could be conducted. The exchange would be responsible for ensuring that that training is conducted. Could be done in a variety of ways, either through exchange staff, through partnerships with the Department of Commerce, for example. There are a variety of ways that that could be done. In terms of to your other question of how the compensation could be set, in the bill, in Representative Atkins' bill, it really leaves it up to the board to establish what that compensation structure is. That could be in the form of grants. It could be in the form of a per-person payment for those that are enrolled. There could be, additional bonuses or incentives for helping people with language issues, enrolling the uninsured, helping those with health disparities, those types of things. So there's really a wide variety of ways that compensation could be structured.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know there's a lot of people that want to ask questions, so I'll wrap up with this one. I'm assuming that there are currently state employees that work in our public assistance programs, for especially medical assistance, that provide assistance in enrolling people. So would some of those same employees that currently work in perhaps Department of Health or something be possible assisters, and would they be compensated with some kind of a bonus structure for signing people up, and are they currently eligible for that?
Ms. Mumlov. Madam Chair, Representative, so I'll give one example. With public programs today, so for medical assistance, the counties are providing a lot of that assistance today. Mm-hmm. That, under the bill as written, would continue to operate as it does today and use existing funding sources to provide that assistance for medical assistance. For the in-person assister program for counties, if they would like to help people enroll if they're determined eligible for the tax credits, they could also get in-person assister funding to help those individuals as well. It's up to the choice of that county whether or not they would choose to do so, but that would be for services they don't provide today.
Representative Liu.
Thank you. But just to make clear, would those any of those employees, whether they're county or state, be eligible for a bonus for signing someone up for the exchange or onto a program, an insurance program?
Mom Love.
Madam Chair, Representative, if they are providing services outside of what they do for medical assistance today to help people eligible for premium tax credits, they would be eligible for the in-person assister program and compensation under that program based on what the structure of that is established. The structure of that compensation is not specified in the bill, but determined by the board.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. And Representative Atkins, this will be my final question. I probably should. But are you aware, is there any other program where we reward government employees for signing people up for programs? I'm more familiar with the tax committee in that, where, you know, it's verboten to basically give a bonus to our revenue employees for, you know, for audits or things like that, and how much money they bring in. We just don't allow that.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Loon, only state troopers, I think, are rewarded for. I am not, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of that. I think it's an excellent point. I would want to explore it further. I'm glad you asked the question.
Good question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good question. And now, Representative Swadinsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question could be either to the author, but kind of goes along the lines of, so the navigator can only navigate people into the program. So, you know, obviously part of the system that I'm going to guess is going to be, you know, picked up and put together is part of your income, whether you're eligible or not. At what point and how does that situation going to work? When someone's income hopefully goes up, they get a job or some other thing happens where they're no longer eligible, will that relationship that's already currently built with that navigator maintain as they transition out of the program, or are they kind of left on their own? So how will that kind of be? Will that be kind of prohibited, or
Ms. Mumlov?
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to make sure that I understand the question. So if an individual, for example, is transitioning off of a public program into, like they got a job and they'd then be eligible for a premium tax credit, is that kind of the situation that you're envisioning?
Well, you know, assume maybe they're no longer eligible for a navigator, essentially, is what I'm saying. So in this program, will that individual, I'm assuming there's going to be some relationships built with some of their customers, will they be barred from navigating them to finding insurance outside of the system?
Ms. Momlop.
Madam Chair, Representative, so if an individual chooses to stay with the exchange to have their coverage, so whether they're in the tax credit or not, or they're eligible for Medicaid, if they choose to continue to have their coverage to the exchange, they can continue to use that navigator to help them find assistance for coverage.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you. Moving into a little bit different area. You know, looking at the bill and then looking at recommendations, kind of going through, there seems to be some particular areas that are maybe kind of went away from or went above and beyond, and then looking at what the kind of the national baselines are. You know, I guess I'm just going to say, why are we going beyond, above and beyond in certain areas from what the federal baselines are in this bill, rather than trying to really try to stay to the minimums as much as possible?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swedzinski. Two reasons, and I would invite Ms. Malmov to join us as well in this answer. I think number one is you only get one chance to make a good first impression, and we want to put a product out there that is as much as it can be, in spite of the very abbreviated timeline that we're on. But we still want to try to put out as good of a product the first time that we can. And then secondly is Minnesota stands apart. Our health care system, our health insurers, and our consumers who've seen fit, most of them, to purchase health insurance, deserve as much of a good product as we can put forth, and one that protects what we've worked very hard at building over the years. With that, and perhaps on a technical basis, I'd invite Ms. Malmov to add to that if she wishes.
Ms. Momlop.
Madam Chair and Representative, I am curious which components of the bill specifically you might be asking about.
You know, primarily in the dental area, and that was going to lead me to a different question, but so, yeah.
In the dental? So on dental, the exchange is required to provide standalone dental plans that are there. Have had some discussions with dental organizations around providing some more specifics in that bill around dental that may be considered at some point, but standalone dental is a requirement that be included on the exchange.
And Madam Chair, if I might add, I'm sorry, Representative Swedzinski, I didn't know you were talking specifically about dental. I've actually met with some of their representatives as well. I'm sure they have with you, and we're working on some additional language. It's not quite there yet. But in 7 or 8 more committee steps, I'm sure it'll be fleshed out very, very well.
All right.
And thank you for raising that point. I should have made a point in my opening comments about trying to work through that a little bit further.
But it's, you know,
Representative,
yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's my understanding that it is not necessarily for adults the requirement, but just pediatrics, so the young kids' coverage. And so, you know, I think that's the difference that I'm really talking about. You know, from the baseline, from the feds, what they're talking about is here, and what we're talking about in the state. There's some decent separation there when it comes to managing this plan, I believe. But
Ms. Momlop.
Madam Chair and Representative, so on that dental, so pediatric dental is a requirement to have on there, and standalone dental as well. You know, really the reason to go beyond just the pediatric version is that when people are looking for health insurance, they're looking for kind of a comprehensive package there. So to Representative Atkins' point, we want to make sure that when the exchange is up and available for consumers, that when they're looking for health insurance and all of those services that they would generally purchase, that information is there and available to them should they want to choose it.
Sure.
Representative.
Okay. Thank you. Kind of moving beyond that, we talked a little bit about appeals process, and you know, part of the portion is you want to be able to have your individuals appeal. if they're denied service or denied coverage. You know, coming from the provider side, looking in, is there anyone going to be elected or responsible to the public at all that is going to be part of the appeals process for maybe a denied of entry in? Because we kind of have almost what we're setting up here is what almost a two-tier system where we may qualify in one area, but you may be disqualified in the other area. Is there a kind of, some of the things in here talking about some separation with the board and how that process may work? Is there going to be some, public input as far as accountability? As we are elected officials, we'll be voting on this and really turning some of those things over.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, if I might, I'd like Ms. Malmov to talk about the technical aspects of the appeal process that they've envisioned, and then I'd like to just reserve about 30 seconds.
Ms. Malmov.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the appeals process, for example, for eligibility determinations, under federal regulations, we need to ensure that those people that are evaluating those appeals were not involved in making the determination. And so there are proposed rules that have been released on appeals that were released and will not be final until sometime probably around March, the March timeframe. And really we're looking at somewhat of a process that could be similar to what DHS does for appeals for medical assistance determination, which is, they are made in-house, but not by those individuals that have made the determination.
Representative?
Madam Chair, the only piece that I'd like to add to that relative to the overall oversight of this is that this body, whoever these board members are under the four corners of this bill, they're still accountable to the legislature and to the people who appoint them. And we are elected officials. They're also subject to the legislative auditor and that oversight. And they're also, finally, and hopefully this will never come to bear, but they're subject to Minnesota's laws, criminal laws, too. So if they make decisions for the wrong reasons, or commit, heaven forbid, something like fraud, they're subject to criminal penalties as well, in addition to the typical appeals process.
Representative, any further questions? Representative Anderson, do your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Malmoff, if this is kind of like, I've been in this movie before. I don't know if you remember this, but we had Health Match in the state of Minnesota. Are you familiar with that at all? Okay. Can you kind of walk us through, do you remember what happened to that and what it was?
Ms. Malmoff.
So Health Match, the eligibility determination system for medical assistance, correct?
Yep. And Ms. Malmoff, we spent as a state $41 million on that program. And it was supposed to do exactly what you're proposing here to do today. It was based on a state-run health system that got people signed up on the health programs, and it was designed to match residents with the appropriate programs. It was based on eligibility. It was supposed to be done in 2 years, and the original allocation was $13 million. 10 years later, we wound up spending $41 million on this, and we also had to pay out a financial settlement to the company that the state had contracted with to do this work to the tune of $7.25 million. Now, this was all done by the Department of Health and Human Services, who I know that you're going to be working in partnership with. What can you tell me is different about this that is not going to lead to the same result of the state spending millions and millions of taxpayers' dollars to have a system fail once more?
Ms. Malmoff.
Madam Chair and Representative, I am not from DHS and was not there at the time that this was done. So in terms of the specifics of that system and what happened, I would really refer that to the Department of Human Services. In terms of this, the eligibility determination system under the ACA really does simplify eligibility for medical assistance and the tax credits. Streamlines that, makes it much easier. There aren't the multiple levels of questions and levels of detail that made eligibility determinations quite complicated in the past. And in terms of the details around the system and the issues that were there, I would refer that to DHS.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Malmoff, can you tell me how many eligibility rules will be in place for doing this?
Ms. Malmoff.
Actually, if, Madam Chair, if someone is from DHS, I can maybe ask them to come down and address that.
Is there someone here from DHS that would like to help answer the question?
Madam Chair, if I might add, though, and I appreciate Atkins. The question, and I'll make sure that Representative Anderson gets an answer to that question, and I anticipate that that question will be one that will be asked in the Health Policy and or Health Finance Committee as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative or Mr. Chair, on getting me that information, because that was one of the main components that the legislative auditor said that the Health Match program failed, is they had 16,000 eligibility rules. And I'm guessing we're going to have a similar number or a large number, again, to deal with in the health insurance exchange. Changing gears here a little bit, I want to kind of piggyback a little bit off of what Representative Woodard's first started out the conversation on. On the data. Now, you had mentioned to Representative Loon that the navigators are going to have to get training and the assisters are going to need to get training on privacy and security. So are they going to have access then to, as they're walking somebody through the system, they're obviously going to see their income level, they're going to see a whole host of different information as they're walking this person through the system to get themselves signed up. What kind of safety precautions, what kind of audits will you do in order to make sure that that information is not abused in some way, shape, or form?
Ms. Momlo.
Madam Chair and Representative, we can get you the details of what those requirements are for privacy and security of that information and the detail that's there. We can get that to the committee.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Melmoth, that would be really helpful because so far government has failed in protecting people's data. We have had three examples within the last year of different government employees viewing people's private data without their knowledge, without their consent, and without the authority of viewing that information and who knows doing whatever with it. And we had a situation just now of a state employee accessing 5,000 records, and they're actually saying it's going to be higher than that when it's the investigation is done. Accessing this information, doing who knows what, and I'm really concerned when we're talking about people's income data, when we're talking about their healthcare data, and the number of different entities that are going to have access to this, that we as a government right now currently don't have a system in place to really protect against that. And everything that I've heard so far doesn't give me comfort that this new system is going to do that, especially given the failure of Health Match and our current failures within our state government right now. So for me personally, I would need to have a lot more more comfort in knowing that these things are going to be taken care of, that you have the technology to protect against privacy data being exposed and abused. The other thing, too, I wanted to bring up, and this is for Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. You mentioned the fiscal note. I'm assuming that this will come back at some point, correct, to this committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the finance component will go to whatever committee.
You mentioned the fiscal note. I'm assuming that this will come back at some point, correct, to this committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the finance component will go to whatever committee is anticipated to have jurisdiction, just like it would for whatever. And I'm honestly, as I sit here, I'm not completely certain. My guess is perhaps Health Finance. But it might be commerce now that we are in the world of being a finance committee. So I appreciate the question. I would also point out you just made a great argument for why we don't want this to be a federally run exchange. If our goal is to protect data, I'm much more comfortable having us do it, even though we've had breaches here in Minnesota. I, for one, am more comfortable having it done by a state entity here in Minnesota than sending it off to Washington, D.C.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, thank you for that. I would hope that we would have this come back to this committee with the fiscal note, because we do have the new responsibility of having the finance component to it. But I appreciate you looking at that issue. Kind of back to the training portion of this whole privacy and security training, how is that paid for? Where does that money come from? Is that part of the 3.5% premium tax? How does that work?
Ms. Momlo.
Madam Chair and Representative, the training that would occur for navigators and for brokers would be under the operational funding under that 3.5% or up to 3.5% into future years.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Melmoth, that's the portion that Representative Woodard kind of pointed out. We don't necessarily know what that budget is right now, because you're not sure of how many navigators or assisters you're going to have.
Ms. Momoth?
Madam Chair and a Representative, we do have estimates there for the training budget that is there, and again, that could be information forthcoming in the fiscal note.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Sanders is up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, I'm just curious. Obviously, there's not a fiscal note yet on the bill. What's the status on the fiscal note for your House file?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Sorry.
Jeez.
We've only known each other for 6 years, you know. My understanding is that it is in a preliminary format at this point, and that we'll see final ones hopefully as soon as possible in light of the rapid but deliberative method or process that this bill is following.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Atkins, I don't think I missed a committee. Could we just have basic overview? What is the fiduciary responsibility of this committee? What jurisdiction financially do we have as the Commerce Committee? I know now, first time in my service here, this is now also a finance committee. So I was just wondering what jurisdiction we have now as a finance committee.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Did I do it again? Sanders.
Yes, you did.
Sanders.
I'm
yeah.
making notes, but that's okay.
We previously, our budget consisted of pizza money, I think. Mm-hmm. We've now been charged with purview of the Department of Commerce budget, the Lottery Gambling Control Board, the Explore Minnesota Tourism, Public Utilities, which is associated with our friends in commerce, energy-related matters, again, associated with commerce. And I believe that rounds out what our responsibility is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Akins, do we have...
Boys.
Representative Atkins, do you anticipate there being portions of the fiscal note that this committee will have jurisdiction over and that we would have to revisit as the Commerce Committee?
Representative
Madam Chair,
Atkins.
Representative Sandusky, I would anticipate that we...
That's crossing the line.
did I go over the line? It's getting late, Representative Sanders.
No.
I would suspect that that's a possibility.
Representative Sanders.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or Madam Chair, Representative Atkins. We'll get this figured out. I do have a question, and that's on page 3, starting off with paragraph D, and then on to line 3.16. This appears, from the way I read this, that you're exempt from all rulemaking authority. And chapter 14 is state agencies' administrative procedure. As I look at the index here, I mean, that section includes, you know, provisions applicable to all rules adopted after public hearings, without public hearings, legal status of rules, record-keeping requirements, being exempt from rules, judicial review, public access, the Office of Administrative Hearings, contested case procedures, judicial review of contested case. Judicial review of contested cases, and I'm just wondering why in the world something this large would be exempted from Chapter 14 and rulemaking authority and what is subject to rules.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sanders. We're taking a page, I guess, from the Republican capitalist playbook, which is to be nimble and able to adapt to a market that is emerging rapidly and changing rapidly. And the goal here was to set forth a model that would be able to adapt to those changing and emerging market trends, that we'd have an opportunity to have products that respond to market needs as they emerge. I should also mention, I anticipate that will be an issue that will be front and center in the Government Operations Committee and perhaps elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sanders.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess it will be. I'm on that committee, so we'll make sure that we address that issue again. And as well, you could be ready with a response for why this bill would also explicitly list Section 14.386, which, again, is the procedure for adopting and exempting rules in that duration. So that was very concerning to me. And part of that also is, if I also am reading this bill correctly, on page 8, it appears, and maybe Representative Atkins, you can just give your thoughts on this, but subdivision 5, it appears that we're going to need a second bill before the end of this session. Is that your intention? Is that correct? I mean, it appears that the legislature before June 1st of this year needs to define these health carrier requirements and participation.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, it provides that opportunity if the legislature wants to follow that course.
Representative Sanders.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, I would I'll put it this way. It's very concerning giving an executive agency or a super agency, whatever you want to call it, such broad authority, not being subject to rulemaking and have the ability to create such definitions and requirements on their own. I guess I would hope that at least we would have some conversations on what that should look like. I concern moving, perhaps what the legislature should be doing, especially when it comes to something of this magnitude and moving it off to a board, which is another question I had.
Representative Sanders and Madam Chair, can I interrupt and ask a question to that point that might save us time?
To that point, yes, Representative Hoppe, please do.
Ms. Malmlov, we are looking at the bill, and I just lost my place, but we're looking at 3.5%, up to 3.5% premium being charged, and it says wherever I had the first place in plans that are offered through the exchange. But when we look at subdivision 5, line 8.5, paragraph 1 or line 1 there, apply uniformly to all health carriers and health benefit plans in the individual market. What I'm wondering, Ms. Malmlov, is if there's any chance that after this becomes law, this is the 3.5%, the up to 3.5% is going to apply to everybody in the individual market and not just people that are getting insurance through the Minnesota insurance marketplace.
Ms. Malmlov.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the up to 3.5% is just on those carriers and plans participating in the exchange.
So I'm happy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last follow-up here. So there's no chance this will go to everybody and wind up for everybody in the individual market?
Ms. Mamlo?
Madam Chair and Representative, as written, for those participating in the exchange.
I'm happy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sanders, were you finished with your questioning, or did you want a follow-up question?
Madam Chair, as a member of the Commerce Committee, is anyone here from the Department of Commerce?
Yes, I do think so.
It would be great if they could come down and we could, as the Commerce Committee, talk with the Department of Commerce about the health care exchange.
Who's coming down?
A long way around, right?
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Madam Chair, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Representative Sanders.
To your question, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome. I guess my maybe just very broadly, I know at one point the Department of Commerce was kind of solely kind of getting this thing off the ground here. If you could just talk about what is the relationship that the Department of Commerce has with the health insurance exchange kind of today.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, you're quite correct in that the Commerce Department was asked to incubate the exchange as it was getting on its feet. This past September, the exchange was transferred to Minnesota Management and Budget under Commissioner Showalter. That decision was made in part because the incubation period at the Commerce Department was always going to be a temporary one, in that the Commerce Department had regulatory expertise that helped, again, in that incubation process. But over time, as it grew and continues to move on its own, it became apparent that there were going to be some conflicts with having the exchange housed at the regulator of the insurance marketplace in Minnesota, or the insurance market broadly in Minnesota.
Representative Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's good to know. And in fact, kind of leads, I guess, to a line of questioning as what will your relationship then be going forward? Are you, will the Department of Commerce still be the ones that are solely in charge of rates and regulations, or will the exchange be able to modify those in any way, or perhaps even modify those rates for, brokers or, just whatever outside of the exchange? So I guess who would have the authority in some of those instances, and in what jurisdiction? Is there an overlap? Do you work in conjunction, or are there just two separate worlds?
Ms. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, I think as Representative Atkins has discussed already in the course of his presentation of the bill, I do think that there is going to be a market outside of the exchange. This will be an opportunity for individuals and small businesses to purchase coverage, but there will be a marketplace still outside of the exchange marketplace, mm-hmm. the exchange environment. And the Department of Commerce serves as the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce serves as the Insurance Commissioner mm-hmm. for the state of Minnesota, and as such is the regulator of the insurance market within the state.
So, Madam Chair, so in other words, is it the sole responsibility of the Insurance Commissioner, which is the Commissioner of Commerce, to regulate, or is the exchange? I mean, who has the supremacy there? Who is the authority when it comes to just in general, whether it be inside of the exchange or outside of the exchange, who's in charge of credentialing who, setting rates?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, the Department of Commerce, as was earlier discussed, will be fulfilling the qualification requirements for any products sold in Minnesota, any insurance products. So that will include products offered for sale in the exchange environment. We are in the process of staffing using federal grant dollars to prepare for insurance producers and companies to make those filings at the Commerce Department. We review them, and we will review them just like we would any other product filing for those form and rate filings. I would note that the Commerce Department does not do the entirety of the market. The Health Department, for example, regulates HMOs in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Sanders.
So is it the position of the Department of Commerce then for any products, benefits, rates that are established within the state of Minnesota, that is going to be and will continue to be established and enforced through the Department of Commerce?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, the Commerce Department will, I think, continue to perform the same functions that it has in the existing marketplace. Nothing in the bill would take that away. I don't mean to give a broad answer to your question, but without sort of specific question, again, form and rate filings, we will continue to review them. Products that are filed to be sold in the marketplace, the Commerce Department will make those determinations whether or not they meet the minimum qualifications for sale in Minnesota.
Representative Sanders.
Madam Chair, like a portion of the bill also mentions dual certification. So that's where a lot of my questions coming from is, why dual certification? I guess I could just ask that question. I guess I'll ask that question. Why dual certification?
Mr. Brickwitty, you have it.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, I guess I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking if the Department of Commerce will certify that plans meet the minimum requirements for sale twice, or
I'll find it here in just a second. Section 6. I'll find it here. I read it earlier in the hearing. So that would be, it appears to be page 8. That's correct. So the exchange is also certifying requirements for health carriers' health benefit plans offered through the Minnesota Exchange Marketplace. So there's appears to be dual certification in that instance. And I'm curious then what the role of the Commerce Committee or the Department of Commerce is in conjunction with the Minnesota Health Exchange, and who is actually kind of running the show, if you will, and what impact that has on all Minnesotans.
Mr. Brickwoody,
and or Representative Atkins. If I might, and Representative Sanders, I had a sense that's where you were directing this to. We're talking about two separate processes. I want to, from the chief authors, if anybody's taken down legislative history or anything like that, I think it's important that the chief authors say that nothing in this bill will change the oversight responsibilities of the Department of Commerce. They don't make them greater. They don't make them less, period. In terms of the certification, there's the standard, and you all know it's no different than any health insurance product that's being sold in Minnesota. You all know that. That's what the department will continue to do. We're not changing that whatsoever. What's proposed in the bill, however, is for the exchange or the marketplace board to have an opportunity to certify certain products as meeting a standard in order to be sold in the exchange. There is then a second level that goes beyond that, which is that active purchaser element that we spoke of earlier. Does that help clarify it, Representative Sanders?
Representative Sanders.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, for now, I guess as much as we can know. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Sanders?
I'll hold off for now. Thank you.
Representative Woodard, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's along those same lines, because I guess I'm not still very clear on that. It says that the exchange board will be responsible for certification. I get that, and will be able to determine which carriers and plans are eligible to be in the exchange. Sounds like that's an additional authority beyond the Department of Commerce. But if you're not under the rulemaking authority, how are those rules going to be made? And how do we know that's an open and fair process, that we're going to make sure that everybody's involved in it and we understand it and it's transparent?
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. Madam Chair, Representative Woodward, there's a couple ways. Number one is that we've got open meeting law requirements that are set forth in the bill. Number two is we maintain legislative oversight. So if the board is moving in a direction that we don't want them to go, we have the ability to take back what whatever powers we've granted them. Number three is the legislative auditor maintains authority to go through and take a look at what they've done, if they've done anything that's out of bounds. So there remain those sorts of protections within the bill. The purpose of what you're referencing here is to allow it to be done in a more rapid fashion that responds to market and emerging issues that may arise.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the answer is that we're exempting rulemaking just for expediency purposes to make this go along faster and be more responsive. Is that right?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodward, I'll just stand by my previous answer, and I'll also direct you to Part C on line 6.16, which says the board shall establish policies and procedures to gather public comment and provide public notice in the State Register, which is also an official document, as you know.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, so it sounds like your intent is to keep it an open and honest process. So I guess I would recommend that you keep it under the rulemaking authority so that it I think you can still be expedient and still be able to serve the exchange and the customer as well without having to try to go around that. And I guess I would make the same recommendation on the sunset provision. You know, the sunset laws is pretty explicit, and you know, every time we have another bill that says, well, this particular agency or this particular area is not subject to the sunset authority, I think is not healthy as well. And I want to go back to a minute about the replacement, Madam Chair, of the DHS systems that we're talking about. So when you put the budget together, did you take into account that all of those resources today that are focused on the DHS program would be moved over, or how does that work? How would that budgeting occur if you're actually taking over a process that exists within DHS today?
Ms. Momlow.
Madam Chair and Representative, so we are required, actually, under federal law and regulations, to cost allocate the cost of that system between what the exchange would use versus what medical assistance would use. And so there is a part that is cost allocated to Medicaid as part of the budget.
Representative Woodard.
So there's a part allocated to Medicaid. What happens to what our DHS personnel and resources are doing today, those functions that they won't be doing in the future? What happens?
Ms. Momlow.
Madam Chair and Representative, this essentially makes the systems operate at DHS more efficiently. I think it, in terms of how operations or systems would change over at DHS, you know, I would refer that to DHS.
Representative?
Okay. So, Madam Chair, thank you. So when you put the budget together, you just assume that you have no changes will happen at DHS, and you'll just take on an additional authority, not doing anything that DHS does today. You're not replacing any processes that DHS does today.
Ms. Momlow.
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of the exchange's budget, what we are doing is cost allocating between the exchange and DHS. Again, questions related to DHS and their operations and systems, I'd refer to DHS.
Okay. Representative Woodard.
So thank you, Madam Chair. There is no overlap then?
Ms. Momlow.
Madam Chair and Representative, in terms of the budget, there's cost allocation that we've allocated for the system between the exchange and DHS. Other than that, in terms of overlap of operations and systems, again, I'd refer that to DHS in terms of how that impacts there.
Okay. Madam Chair, is there a representative from DHS that might be able to answer that question?
Yes, there is, Dr. Welcome, Doctor. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Jim Golden, Deputy Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at Human Services.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, thank you for being here this evening. I know it's a late evening, but this is obviously an important question. We had heard testimony that part of what's going on here is a rebuilding of a 25-year-old system that DHS has today, and that's where the money that the feds are giving us is going to. In addition to that, we have a 3.5% tax that's going to go on that a year before we even start, so we'll start filling the slush fund a year early. And the question is, from a DHS standpoint, what resources are you performing today? What services are you performing today that would be part of this new system, and how does that affect you when we have this additional budget that's going into the exchange and doing some of the work that I think DHS is performing today?
To the testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative, so at the Department of Human Services, we currently have an eligibility system that calculates and determines eligibility for all of the healthcare and social service programs. And so it is in desperate need of being replaced. And for the purposes of the healthcare programs, particularly those portions of Medicaid that are have the eligibility determined using the MAGI methodology, mm-hmm. which are the same methods that the exchange uses, the exchange and the Department of Human Services would be using the same IT system, the same IT software. This is easily the most economical for both the exchange and the Department of Human Services. In situations like this, the federal law requires that the costs associated with those systems be cost allocated. So that means that each program that is using the system or software is responsible for their percentage use of that system. And they have a variety of mechanisms by which they would do that. In the case of an eligibility determination, I think we would probably look at the number of individuals going through the exchange, what percentage of those are Medicaid, and for some of the IT costs, we would be allocated those costs on that percentage.
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, or Madam Chair, sorry. So what is that cost?
Mr.
In
Golden.
Dollars.
Mr. Golden. Able to answer?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have that here. Actually, it might be easier to have the exchange because they have the spreadsheet that has that typed in for us.
Thank you. Join us.
We phoned a friend, Madam Chair.
Yes, that's a good friend.
Financial officer from the marketplace available for them.
Welcome. State your name, please, for the tape.
Thank you. Barb Julek, the Chief Financial Officer for the Exchange. On the handout that was provided earlier, you'll notice there's three columns under each grant, and the far right column under each grant reflects how much we are anticipating to allocate to Medicaid under each of those grants. And so for the, well, there's $110 million of federal funds under the grant, there's an additional just doing some fast math. Some reason I'm getting my fast math doesn't work in person. around $40 to $55 million of Medicaid match on top of that. So between the grants and the Medicaid match would be the total cost of the project.
Okay. Representative Woodward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is that total cost of the program a line item here that I can see?
I can provide it to you, but the grant piece is $110 million and the MA piece is $55 million. So I think it would be about $165 million so far.
Okay. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So it's safe to say that the exchange is now $165 million to build?
Current estimate.
Ms. George.
$165 million. Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's enlightening. Thank you. And thank you for helping out. That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Last line of questioning, Representative Atkins, I swear, for me. And I know you've been very diligent in answering our questions, and it certainly is much appreciated. You had made comment a minute ago that Representative Anderson had a good point about why we shouldn't let the feds do this, why we should do it ourselves because of data privacy. But earlier testimony had talked about that this data that goes in here, and it was, I was told that civil law was going to pursue this, but I think you brought it up. So this data that's going into the R exchange actually goes to the feds too. What is the difference in us building the exchange versus the feds when the data is still going to the federal government and we're not protecting it any differently than the federal? I mean, it's only as good as what the feds are going to end up with their own security, correct?
Representative Atkins.
Chair, Representative Woodward, I'd first let Ms. Malmov do the technical piece of that, and then I'd like to add a few comments as well.
Ms. Malmov.
Madam Chair, Representative. So really the information from the federal hub is to use as verification of information that's provided by the individual. That information is not provided by the individual, is not provided to the federal government or through the hub. The information in the hub is to help verify the information provided by the individual to the exchange.
Representative Woodard.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I thought earlier testimony was that it does go to, you mentioned DHS and IRS as two, DHS, meaning Homeland Security, as being two agencies that the data did go to. Now you're saying it's not?
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, what I mentioned was that the data is there to be used for eligibility determination. So there's information available from the Department, from Homeland Security, Social Security Administration, and the IRLs to help verify information to determine eligibility.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But in order to do that, you have to feed the data to them, correct?
Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, no, that information is not shared with them. That information is provided to the exchange, and those data sources are used as verification.
Representative Woodard.
I guess I'm really confused, but I don't understand how that works. How do you do that, verify it, without giving them data?
Ms. Malmlove. Ms. Malmlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, tried to explain how the IT system works, and I'm not an IT expert in this area. But essentially, the data sources that are there are used as reference, are being able to be looked at by the exchange to verify that the information provided by the individual.
Okay.
It doesn't go the reverse way.
Is it fair to say, Madam Chair and Representative Woodward, that we are getting information from the federal government? Mm-hmm. And I asked this question of Ms. Malma. Mm-hmm. We are getting information mm-hmm. that they house at the federal level to confirm what the applicant has supplied to us. We are not feeding data to the federal. Is that, I'll leave that, is that accurate? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Representative Woodward?
Okay.
And then I asked for just a few seconds in addition to that, Madam Chair,
yes, because well,
three points on that particular point, which is, number one, we still have HIPAA and privacy laws, both federal and state privacy laws. Number two is we have state protections. Number three is we have state oversight by our Commerce Department, as well as Department of Health and others. And that's why I think it's beneficial to have this be at a state level rather than at a federal level. And I appreciate the couple extra seconds at the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it safe to say, and you know, maybe it's comfort language that would help us out here, that the federal government will have, won't be housing this data in any way, shape, or form. They won't see the data in any way, shape, or form. That it all is housed within Minnesota's exchange, and that we're just going to bounce that data. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth on how exactly that works, but you know, we had talked about, based on what you just said, it's a pretty easy answer. Department of Homeland Security would not be able to determine that you are an illegal alien and need to be apprehended and deported because they would never see that information. If that's the case, it should be pretty easy maybe to do an amendment that makes sure we clarify that information never is housed by the feds and that this magical way in which we can send them data without sending them data works.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Woodward, and I appreciate you calling attention to this issue. There is actually a compliance officer for privacy concerns, and I try to answer every question that committee members have, regardless of what committee that we're in, but that compliance officer is not here with us this evening, and I fully expect that this will be vetted fully when we get to the Civil Law Committee, and which is charged with that responsibility of talking about data privacy. I'm not trying to push off your question. I just want to make sure we give you the most accurate answer possible.
Okay. Representative Woodard.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Malmoff, I'm going to go back, if you'll pardon me for a minute, to what we were chatting about before on page 8, line 8.5. When we're wondering, and I was wondering about the 3.5%, and will that apply? And you said it wouldn't apply as written. So if Health Partners or somebody else that's selected to be somebody in the exchange offers a plan, an insurance plan for people, and it's that plan is available to people both in and out of the exchange, would the people that opted for that plan that were not getting it through the exchange be subject to the 3.5%?
Ms. Momlop.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the 3.5% is a withhold from premiums on plans sold through the exchange only.
I'm happy.
So just so I'm clear, so if, and maybe it's an insurance question, maybe there can't be a plan that's sold through the exchange and not through the exchange. But if there can be, if I go get, you know, whatever the insurance plan is called and I'm in the exchange, I'm going to be paying 3.5%. Representative Sanders goes gets the same plan on his own through a broker or whatever, he's going to have the same insurance coverage, he's just not going to pay the 3.5%.
Ms. Mama.
Madam Chair, Representative, so if a plan was sold inside the exchange and outside the exchange and was the same plan, the mm-hmm. consumer would pay the same premium for the same plan. It is a withhold from the premium that would go to the carrier that would go to the exchange for those plans sold through the exchange.
Okay, that's what I thought. The way it was written was a little ambiguous, and the way you answered it before, I didn't understand that. Thank you. Can I ask Representative Atkins or Ms. Malmov, when all is said and done, where is the exchange going to fall? Who's ultimately going to have the oversight? Will it be the Commerce Committee or the Commerce Department?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hoppe. And at risk of repeating myself a little bit, there's actually multiple layers of oversight for it, from the Department of Commerce to the Legislative Auditor to the Legislature, to the extent that there's criminal malfeasance, there'd be public safety personnel. There's also federal. There was a full page of oversight responsibilities in your packet as well.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins. And I was looking through the bill again, looking at Section 11, the transition of authority, prompted me to ask that. I know you had spoken about that earlier, and it looks like we're setting up something entirely new, and I just didn't know exactly how it's going to wind up reporting. And being that it's dealing with insurance, I want to make sure that it comes under the Department of Commerce as much as humanly possible.
And I should have mentioned there's also a legislative report built into it as well. So thank you for the reminder.
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, I know you walked through the bill earlier, but Representative Sanders had a good idea. Would you mind just kind of walking through it again? Just, and I hate to belabor it, just the oversight portions.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair and Representative Hoppe, some of the oversight goes without saying, because you're talking about the Department of Commerce, which has oversight over insurance products. There's also the reference, and with all due respect, to the legislative auditor, legislative reporting. I'd have to go through and look for the specific sections. If you'd like to keep asking questions, I'll find those sections and then get back to you without holding up the committee's time.
Okay.
Happy.
I have another question. And for Ms. Malmov, I'm curious. If I'm right now somebody who is getting single health coverage just for myself, if I'm unmarried, I'm a young, healthy guy that's got a job where I don't get insurance, or I'm a subcontractor or whatever, and now I'm going to get insurance through the exchange, if I'm getting roughly the same insurance, will I be paying more or less when all the dust settles here?
Ms. Baumlob.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you are someone that is that has an income below 400% of the federal poverty level, and if you're getting coverage through the exchange, you would be eligible for premium tax credits that would reduce the cost of your insurance.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For that's it for right now.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, yep.
Representative. And Representative Zellers.
Chair, and Representative Hoppe actually asked one of my questions. So I wanted to go back to Representative Woodard asked a question, too, about the collection in 2014. If I understood the testimony correctly, the feds are paying for this through 2014. So why are we collecting then? What's the money going to be used for, and why are we collecting? Again, not that federal money is free, it's just our money laundered through D.C., but what are we collecting money for in 2014?
Ms. Baumlob.
Madam Chair and Representative, the money collected in 2014 is to establish an operational reserve, just for fiscal prudence, kind of any, you know, type business entity having a reserve for up years and down years. The operational funding for the exchange does come from enrollment, so the exchange is going to need to attract enrollment. And in those initial years, enrollment could be different from projections, so this provides a operational reserve for the exchange.
Representative Zellers.
That sounds like a really bad idea, but it's your bill, Representative Atkins. So we're going to establish a slush fund for marketing money.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, would you refer to, do you have a reserve in your business? You have, with all due respect, you keep calling it a slush fund.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a reserve is a reserve. The state has a reserve. You can consider that, Mr.
Right. And we filled it back up, Representative Atkins. I'm happy we did that. But I look at it in the back here. And if you look in section, you look on page 6, it says, and the reason I ask, it's not because I'm in any way offending the idea of having a reserve, but in here it says that the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace shall retain or collect 3.5 total premium individual market, blah, 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 and shall retain them. So they're not going to, if there is any extra or any overage, it won't go back. They get to hold on to the funds. And that's something that, I guess, if if you're getting to create a government agency and you want to be able to do that, that's great. I don't know that we allow other agencies that to collect more than they need and then to keep the excess. So my question then is, that's why I asked the question, is why collect before we need it, and then if there is overages, why not give it back?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, it says for the operations of the marketplace. It is in no, in it, to operate a reserve account is only financially prudent, no different than what the state does. And it, to the extent that there are excess funds for operations, I would anticipate that the amount collected, the percentage charged as a withhold, would not be required to be as much.
Representative Zellers.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but the testimony earlier was we don't know how many of the helpers, whatever they are, navigators, we don't know how many navigators there are. We don't know necessarily yet from the testimony from DHS what the total cost is going to be for the IT upgrades, rewrites, whatever that may be. So that's why I asked why we're collecting before we need to, and then why, if once we do know the budget, why we're allowing them to keep the overage, why not then refund that to the ratepayers that are going to be paying this 3.5% or 2 to 3.5% fee.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, thank you for the observation. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you that if the operations are not as costly as anticipated, then the amount that needs to be collected as a withhold would not need to be as high. I agree.
Representative Zellers.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chairman. One of the, and at your encouragement, I did look through the spreadsheet, and maybe for you, Mr. Chair, that was the governor or chief of staff or several commissioners aware that we were paying consulting fees as a part of the exchange?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, I did not have that conversation with them. I'm not.
Maybe Ms. Belmont.
Ms. Belmont would have more information.
Ms. Mama.
Madam Chair, Representative, sorry, can you repeat that question?
So, at your encouragement, I looked through the spreadsheet and it says in here we're paying consulting fees. And I just was asking whether or not the governor's chief of staff, or legislative affairs director was aware that we were paying consulting fees in formation of this health insurance exchange.
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair and Representative, our application to the federal government of what we would use the funds for does include a variety of contracts with private entities to provide services to the exchange. That information that has been submitted in for federal grants did have the approval of the commissioner, and to submit those grants, that requires a letter of support from the governor as well.
So, yes. The reason I ask, and I'm not sure if you were here during that discussion, but there was quite a public, some would say humiliation, but cross-examination of consultants that came in and offered some free advice to us in the last couple of years on how to maybe save more in the budget, be more a little bit more prudent in purchasing any number of different things, and we were routinely criticized for actually asking consultants to come in and give their advice. And as I can see it in here, we've paid several millions of dollars in consulting fees. So I was just wondering if was a part of it. And actually, it's Gruber and Gorman are two different people. I see in here we've paid not quite $1 million that I can see on the spreadsheet to these folks. And my question is, based on how much we paid them, why this study isn't done and presented to us, and quite frankly, why they're not here.
Ms. Momlove.
Madam Chair, Representative, so we have, we contracted with Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman to do actuarial and economic modeling. The first results of that modeling and the report from that was released in April of 2012. That is available, report that is available. We have also contracted with them to provide an update to those results, which are the results that we have received just recently. The report, the updated report on those results will be coming out shortly.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And did you talk to Dr. Stinson? Did you use any of the actuarials that are at the Commerce Department for any of this research?
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative, we use Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman. They have one of the very few actuarial and economic modeling simulations that provides information on enrollment changes and also premium shifts, how that impacts a desire to get coverage. They are one of the few entities nationwide that has that capability.
Representative Zellers.
So, no, but you should have. Dr. Stinson's a pretty smart guy. The other question I had, Madam Chair, was under the classification responsibilities and powers. I'm curious, in Section 1 there, the director and the managerial staff are going to be unclassified service employees, and I'm curious as to the rationale of that.
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative, can you direct me, sorry, to the language again? You
said? Page 5, Section 6 at the bottom. Or at least the copy of the bill that I got. Maybe it's the responsibilities and powers of the Minnesota insurance marketplace.
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative, the language that's here is reflective of task force recommendations from the Exchange Advisory Task Force. They advise that the entity be a public-private entity and that it be able to hire and retain staff with appropriate expertise, and that that expertise reflect both expertise in the public and private sectors and have flexibility to bring in that staff.
Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So very possibly then that the director or managerial staff will be paid more than the governor of the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Momloff?
Madam Chair, Representative, the language in this bill allows the board to establish the compensation for that managerial staff. Compensation level could be below the governor or could be above the governor. It's at the discretion of the board.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one last question on the personnel. So are any of the folks that were a part of building the marketplace, the website, however you'd like to classify it, going to be eligible and applying for the positions? Because one of the things we heard a lot about is we can't have insurance companies, insurance agents involved in this because they would have some sort of financial incentive in being a part of the marketplace, so we can't have them involved. So would anybody who is a part of building the, whether it be the incubation stage that the Commerce Department talked about or this final product?
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the bill it provides for all personnel, resources, assets that exist at MMB being worked on the exchange would be transferred to the board and are their assets and personnel. Under the language, the board has the ability to hire, fire, determine whatever personnel that they would have.
Representative Zellers.
So again, maybe I'll ask the chair. Mr. Chairman, as you understand it then, anyone who worked on building, providing for the consultants, whoever were a part of this, they can be hired then to run the Minnesota Healthcare Exchange.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think the hypocrisy stands for itself. We can't have people who are in insurance, we can't have people who are in healthcare be a part of this board, yet the very people who built it are going to be able to be employed here, and believe me, I'm all for having, I'm sure Representative Ann Zellers would slap me on the side of the head, I'm all for having non-union employees work in government, but the fact that they're non-classified and can be paid more, I think that yet another part of the bill that's very concerning. And again, if what's good for the goose is good for the gander, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, folks at health plans could apply for those positions as well. They're not excluded from working for the exchange, being executive directors or IT personnel. It's just the board of directors for the exchange for which there was the most language added relative to having conflicts of interest.
But, Madam Chair?
Yes.
But, Chairman Atkins, they can't for 1 year, correct? Which, if you're anybody who, I mean, granted, it's a government agency, so next to death and taxes, it's the most permanent thing that we'll create down here. But if you're not on the front end of it, if you're exempt for 1 year, you can't apply for one for the first full year, correct?
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers and Ms. Malmaffer will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think anybody could apply to be the director of this thing. The board, however, has explicit what you described without going through it yet again.
I can defer, Madam Chair, but I'm pretty sure I read in there that you can't apply to be an employee either. Ms. Malmaffer?
Ms. Malmaffer. Care to answer?
Madam Chair, Representative, the conflict of interest provision, the one-year provision is for board members only. There isn't a restriction on hiring for the employees that the board would hire.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'm going to phone a friend too, Representative Atkins. Subdivision 4 on page 4, within 1 year prior to or at any time during their appointment, a board member appointed under blah, 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 may not be employed, be a member of a board of directors, or otherwise be a representative of a health carrier.
Right.
So that's not, they can't be an, so they can, they could be hired to be an employee. If they're working for Blue Cross or Health Partners right now, they could be hired to be an employee, just not the director.
Representative Atkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, this is talking about the composition of the board. If you reference, I believe if you go all the way up to the top, you'll see under Section 5, it's defined as government, and then governance, then it talks about the board and the appointment process and the requirements for board members. Sure. Thank you for clarifying that, though.
Well, I know, and I, again, Madam Chair, and to the Chair, I will renew my also concern that the people who are building the system are going to be able to be hired to then benefit from some which could be on the low end, but also could be on the high end, could be a substantial windfall for them being hired into the system that they just built. Yet, we can't have people who work in insurance and work in healthcare be a part of the board. I think that hypocrisy is pretty glaring in the bill, and I think it should be something that would be corrected if you're going to try to earn any of our members' support on this side of the aisle.
So, Representative Zellers, if we do change that, we'll earn all the members of your side support?
Nice start.
Well, members, I do not have anyone else on the list for questions. If you've all completed your questions this evening, I'm going to throw it back to you, Representative Atkins, to your bill, and you can have the last word.
Thank Madam Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call on the bill.
Roll call is requested.
I was going to ask for one, too.
Okay.
I was about to say so. But Madam Chair and members, I think in light of the time, and I mostly just want to say my thanks and appreciation and gratitude and any other words I can come up with to say thank you to members of the committee. For their diligence, their questions, their staying here, and I've already spoken too long. I will renew my motion that House File 5 be reckoned and passed, referred to the Committee on Government Operations as amended.
And a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Atkins?
Aye.
Representative Fritz?
Aye.
Representative Poppy?
No.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Van Zyl?
Yes.
Representative Davids? Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Halverson?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
Yes.
Representative Portman?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Schoen?
Yes.
Representative Slocum?
Yes.
Representative Sundin?
Yes.
Representative Swedzinski?
No.
Representative Woodard?
No.
And Representative Zellers?
There being 12 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much.
And thank you, Representative. And thank you all for your testimony, and thank you all for your questions, and we are...